This podcast is part of the Erotica Podcast Network. We offer a free Erotica podcast and a premium Patron Taboo podcast which contains more intense sexual themes. You can subscribe to the premium podcast for $2 per month or support the Erotica Podcast on Patreon to support us and allows members to request future stories and themes. Thank you for listening. This podcast contains mature content and is intended for an adult audience only. It contains explicit words, thoughts, and ideas. The content of all stories is fiction with any similarities to real people or events being purely coincidental. This podcast is not intended for anything but entertainment of the listener, and if you do not agree with the themes listed in the tags, please do not listen to the story. All characters engaging in sexual relationships or activities are 18 years old or older. This story was found on a free website and brought to audio form here. I did not write and take no credit for this story. Please visit the link in the comments to further support this author. Dream Drive by Overed. Chapter 01. There were 7 days left in the summer preceding Jackson Vidalt's final year of high school. Jackson hated high school, but today, he wasn't worried about that. Today, he wasn't worried about anything. Nothing could go wrong today. He sat in his room, alone. It was dark. It was 4 a.m. The sun wasn't up yet. He lived a Spartan existence. His bed was done in white sheets. The walls pale tan. The floor was plain hardwood. His bookshelf was packed tight and arranged alphabetically by the last names of the authors, and divided by section into fiction and non-fiction. The shelf represented only a fraction of his library. The vast majority was digital. He liked having hard copies of his favorite books. Something to hold on to, something to feel. The sensation of pages flipping through fingers, that was something computers couldn't do. Well, not until recently anyway. There was almost no dust in the room. Jackson hated dust almost as much as he hated high school. His only true companion was a bottle of Windex, which he kept in a drawer in his nightstand. His desk was a break from the strict conservatism. It ran the length of one entire wall, turned the corner, and kept going for another half of the room. The majority was made of wood. The shorter segment was plastic and steel. On the countertop, 5 optical hard drives had been opened up and were soldered onto a custom-built stack. A series of carbon circuit graphics cards, an exposed router, and a green and silver motherboard connected various ports and terminals. The stalk of a microphone protruded from the mess, and a fat set of headphones hung from it like a drunk hanging off a friend on the way home. Somehow, 3 computer monitors were jacked into the tangle, glowing with the same black and white screensaver that flashed across the room in a hypnotic strobe. It looked like the aftermath of a wrestling match between a mad scientist and his computer. That was not far from the truth. Jackson wasn't sure how luck worked, but he figured that for some people, it was on a low burn all the time, and for others, it came in big spurts. He was the second type. While other kids had been getting their first kisses, he'd gotten into Bitcoins very early. He had over $20,000 in a slow-growth investment fund, and his checking account wasn't doing bad, either. Bitcoin was short for virtual coin. It was yet another spin-off of the Bitcoin, the infamous monetary device that had spawned a wave of cryptocurrencies. Their popularity initially spiked, then fell over time. 40 years later, as the virtual world became more and more integrated with reality, Bitcoins formed the peak of the second wave, but it was less like a wave and more like a flood. Mining for Bitcoins had been Jackson's first big learning experience with computers. He'd always escaped to his computer to get away from life, but that was when he stopped simply using his computer and started manipulating it. Mining was the action of contributing computing power to the Bitcoin public exchange system, which constantly logged all Bitcoin transactions the world over. In exchange, the user of the computer was given Bitcoins based on the amount of work they'd contributed. Jackson lost himself in a sea of customized hardware and optimized code, all to mine Bitcoins faster. It was like a game, but one with real rewards. His mother didn't know about his stash, but then, his mother didn't know about a lot of things. He didn't think she'd care much about anything other than spending it, but that was years ago. For the past 4 nights, Jackson had been preparing for something else. He'd been hard modding his dream drive well past legal limits, connecting it directly to his rig so as to optimally distribute the processing load. He wanted to experience ISIS on full settings without so much as a hitch. The chaos on his desk was, in fact, his rebuilt computer just dismantled and spread out. A lot. He hadn't had time to build a new case. And before him, finally finished, was his upgraded dream drive. A serial bus linked the polished red helmet to the nest of electronics. He didn't plan on taking it anywhere, but he didn't want to sacrifice mobility, so the port was detachable. Just in case, he hefted the object in his hands. The black visor made it look like a motorcycle helmet. Even 6 years after the technology had been invented, it was still something to wonder at. It was the machine that could transport a human being into a virtual world. The dream drive intercepted normal nervous system impulses at the base of the spinal cord, and was capable of imitating the body's normal sensory input back into the brain. Vision, hearing, smell, touch, and even taste could all be replicated with fine-tuned precision. The more esoteric sensory items weren't left out: heat and cold, balance, pain, pleasure. The end result was that you had direct control over your virtual self. More importantly, you felt as though everything going on in the virtual world was real. Meanwhile, your actual body relaxed peacefully in a chair or bed. Perception is reality. In taking advantage of their own nature, humans had engineered a device that, for all intents and purposes, could let them do whatever they wanted in virtual space. They had created their own matrix, and they could completely control what it looked like and how it worked. And they'd done it all without those nasty plugs in the back of your neck. He held his drive in his hands. He'd pulled an all-nighter in a bid to finish on time. His mind was still spinning, coming off the satisfying high of constant, intense work finally completed. The room smelled acrid from all the soldering he'd done, his vision unfocused, a product of the exhaustion. Too many hours hunched over his desk in concentration. His eyes wanted to not look at things. He could have bought a drive earlier, but in order to get payouts from virtual games to a real-life account or even participate in them, he had to be over 18. Hacking the drive's company-side servers wasn't unheard of, but they were some of the most secure mainframes in the world. They subcontracted to the U.S. military cyber defense department. Jackson knew where he would have started, but he figured he wouldn't get very far if he tried. So, he'd waited. His memory started sliding around. Dream drive. He remembered when he first got his helmet, just after his 18th birthday gift to himself. The first thing he did was explore the Dream's default world, the Dream Hub. Everyone and everything intersected in the hub. It was a virtual New York City meets Shanghai, the world showcase of virtual reality, bigger and better than anything in actual reality. It was a massive global fair that never ended, set in a metropolis that was always expanding. He'd been swept up in a gaming competition. They were constant throughout the virtual world. Physical limitations were obsolete, because virtual sports meant little when you could will yourself to run faster than a world champion sprinter with the easy flick of a neuron. The only thing that mattered in cyberspace was brainpower. If nothing else, Jackson Vidalt was a hell of a gamer. His success in a series of games earned him a few hundred bitcoins, about five times the value of a US dollar, and made him fast friends. Those friends invited him to a bar. Jackson had never been to a bar, but the Dream played by international rules. He hadn't even considered it an option, but now that he was legally an adult, he could go wherever he wanted. The virtual world simply refused access to such places for anyone underage. A few lines of programming were the world's most formidable bouncer. He should have seen past the thin smiles and the slaps on the back. His self-titled friends were freeloaders, riding on his success, attaching themselves to someone they thought was a winner. But he wasn't great with people. He still wasn't. He was happy just to have the attention. He was shocked to discover that virtual drinking was just as good as the real thing. He quickly fine-tuned his settings to take the edge off the double vision and some of the other less pleasant side effects. Of course, the outright bad stuff, like nausea, was off by default, and it was impossible for it to change your memories. The Dream would let you drink yourself into a stupor, as long as you kept putting down bitcoins, but it never blacked you out. It turned out that the bar was just a pregame. Their real destination was a club. Jackson had never been to a club either. He was starting to feel like he was getting in over his head. He didn't belong in a group like this. He didn't go bar hopping. He just didn't. But he wasn't himself, not in the virtual world. He designed his avatar to look like himself if he'd been a few inches taller. And had a stronger chin. And smooth hair that was never out of place. And he got rid of the mole on his right cheek. He gave himself a slight tan, just a healthy glow, nothing crazy. And of course, why not add a little muscle? Just something to flex when he moved. He came out looking something like the love child of himself and Brad Pitt. But after the drinking and the carousing and the retelling of their virtual championship, Jackson felt invincible. He let himself be dragged to a place called Nightfire, where they were meeting with some of his friend's friends. Nightfire was a thin brick building tucked between two massive skyscrapers. It was 3 stories tall from the outside, but appearances were deceptive in virtual space. A building that was a single-story house from the street could be a sprawling manor within. What really got his attention was the name of the club blazing away on the brick. It was on fire, or rather, it was fire, shaped into letters. He could feel the heat on his face as they stepped inside. It was dark. The bass of drum-filled techno felt like it was coming from everywhere at once. Spotlights and nightlights showed him snatches of people, hundreds of dancers. Others lingered at a long bar that snaked past the multi-tiered dance floor. He followed at the back of his group, trailing along like a puppy looking for its owner. They made their rendezvous at one end of the bar. His friends' friends were girls. Women. Jackson was bad with people, but women were aliens, as far as he was concerned. They occupied different dimensions. The faint taste of victory that had gotten him this far rushed out of him like a deflating balloon. He caught a few snatches of conversation, heard a dozen new names. Smiles were flashed. He wasn't sure if they were for him. Everyone started laughing at a joke that Jackson had missed. He forced a smile and a chuckle. Suddenly, everyone in his group paired off. It happened quickly, immediately, following the rules of a mating ritual Jackson didn't understand. They slipped into the mass of bodies. In a heartbeat, he was alone. The lights were flashing in his eyes. The thrumming beat pounded in his chest. He was buzzed like crazy. He felt lost. He wondered what he was doing here. He felt a push on his shoulder. One of his friends. He pointed into the club at a girl. She was being pushed by one of her own friends, someone Jackson had been introduced to so briefly he'd already forgotten her name. Then they were standing together. Close. Too close. It felt like a bubble had formed around them. The club turned into a silent, surrealist painting. She looked at him, then back down at her feet. Hey. Her voice was light, and perfectly clear. One of those advantages of the virtual world: if you directed your voice at someone specific, you didn't have to shout to be heard, even when the music was so loud you couldn't hear your own thoughts. Jackson's brain was trying to formulate a response. It was doing a poor job. She was shorter than him, but she had an ageless sort of look, the kind that put her anywhere between 18 and 30. Her ears were sharp, elfin. Her eyes glowed neon green. Short-cut brown hair framed her face. His eyes dropped lower, following the cleavage of her breasts to where it dipped down beneath a skin-tight dress that matched her eyes. The dress wrapped her thighs in a tube of latex. When he looked back up, he saw her watching him. There was a small smile on her lips. He scoured his brain for something clever. Hey. She laughed then. It was a half-cough sort of laugh, not even a giggle. But it made him laugh in response, and his laugh made her start really laughing. They set one another off until they were practically supporting one another to keep from falling flat in the middle of the club. When they stopped, her hand was on his arm. His hand was on her shoulder. She grinned. So, you wanna dance? Until that moment, Jackson had never danced in his life.
Yeah.
He said.
I do.
His hands found the small of her back. She draped herself from his shoulders. They held each other closely. She smelled like flowers. He didn't know flowers well enough to tell what kind. They danced slowly, stepping back and forward. They ignored the sound in the club, the rhythm, the techno. They had their own rhythm. It felt like standing on an island in a sea of limbs and scents and sounds. He rubbed her back with his thumb. She smiled and rested her head against his chest. Having a woman like this press her body against him was definitely new. He was reacting in a way that was excruciatingly familiar. He could feel his face turn red. He could feel something else down below. An ugly part of him ached to press his hardness into her, use her like a tool to rub himself off. Some shred of better judgment kept his body in check. She met his gaze and bit her lower lip. Her hips pressed into his. He was so surprised that, for a moment, he didn't react. She could feel him down there, and she wasn't upset. He'd been preparing himself for a slap in the face. He was getting something a lot better.
Hey.
She looked up at him with those glowing green eyes.
You can put your hands lower.
If you want. Jackson slid his left hand down her back. He went tentatively, like a child testing a toe in pool water. The curve of her butt greeted his fingertips. He risked going lower, an inch at a time, and suddenly, his hand was cupping her ass through her dress. He squeezed once, and pulled her closer. Soft. He didn't even realize he'd said that word aloud until she tightened her arms around his neck, pushing her breasts against him. Her hips ground in a slow, delicious circle.
Hard.
She whispered. The gentle rhythm they'd had shattered. The heavy pounding in the air became their heartbeats. He grabbed her with both hands and began pushing her into himself. He felt a slow, burning warmth on his hardness. He almost shivered every time her body rubbed it. She bit her lip again as she pushed into him. She was using her leverage on his shoulders to drag herself up, then let herself fall. It was tantalizing, teasing, plenty enough to keep him hyper-aware of his erection, and not nearly enough to do anything for him. They lost all sense of pretense. They were grinding against one another in mutual pleasure, a sort of half-sex, half-dance, rubbing one another through their clothes. He squeezed her ass again, and she gasped. The breath rushed over his ear. He squeezed her harder. I in the mess of bodies, they were just one more pair, one more couple, totally visible, and totally invisible. Somewhere in that heat they exchanged names. Hers was Sophia. He told her his name was John, just an alias he'd made up on the spot. A voice in his head told him the white lie wouldn't matter. He was dancing with a hot girl in a nightclub. He could do anything. His hands grew more bold, roaming farther across her body. He ran his fingers up over her hips, along her back. He raised a hand to her neck and thumbed her collarbone. He trailed it back down. She tore away before he could set his grip again, stepping back once, twice. Her neon stare never left his face. Then she moved closer, tossing her head back, giving her hips a roll. She waited a half step away, a seductress challenging him to take the last bit of space. Jackson was the cerebral type. He shunned the idea of losing his self-control. But when she stared at him like that, daring him forward, something instinctual took over. He was there in a moment. His hands were on her, riding her hips, then finding her ass again. His fingers clenched at her, dragging her back to him. She inhaled sharply and embraced him. He leaned down and pressed a kiss on her. Her mouth was open and willing. Their tongues locked around each other. They were grinding again, fighting to push themselves closer. She humped him, hard, almost to the point of chafing him. It was obscene, animalistic, but because everyone else was doing it, no one cared. Their tongues kept fighting. One of his hands was clutching at her waist. On impulse, he reached up and grasped her breast, groping it through the fabric, pinching it in his fingers. He felt the rush of her breath leave her mouth and enter his. She broke away from their kiss.
Let's go.
To a room.
Yeah.
She grabbed his wrist and led him through the shifting pack of bodies. They emerged in a cramped sort of hall between the dance floor and the bar. Up on the higher tier, Jackson could see a wide circle of people clapping in rhythm. One man was breakdancing in the center of the ring. He gripped Sophia's hand tighter. Sophia. That was her name. He'd almost forgotten it, like a word sliding down the back of his throat, riding away on the buzz of alcohol. But he lassoed it back at the last minute. He repeated it to himself like a mantra, trying to calm his hammering heart. They reached a series of red doors that were flickering with their own fire. It felt hot. Sophia put a hand on the doorframe. An alert flashed in front of Jackson, the ubiquitous floating text of the dream's heads-up display. User request. PPrincess255 has invited you to a private room in Nightfire. Accept. Deny. Dash. Accept. The world washed white. He was standing in the dream's loading screen, an endless, blank expanse. People called it white space. He felt a warm, tingling hum in his body,
as if every nerve was lazily waking up, and then he was back on his feet, in his jeans and button-down shirt. He was in a dimly lit room covered in maroon carpeting. There was a fireplace to his right. A red couch sat in front of it. To the left was a small bar, followed by a television and a few chairs. The quiet was sudden. It felt like he'd stepped into a library. He eyed the couch. "Did you want to sit?" Sophia was already heading to a door past the bar.
"Well?"
She opened the door. He couldn't see the room past her.
"More like lay down."
She threw a smoky look at him over her shoulder, then slipped away. Jackson followed her. The room beyond was the same warm maroon. The space was dominated by one of the largest beds Jackson had ever seen. It was neatly folded with dark red blankets and orange pillows, just cheesy enough to remind him of where he was, but good enough to get the job done. Or so he imagined. Sophia was sitting on the bed, facing him. She folded her legs, then bit her lip. It wasn't an effort this time. She looked a bit nervous.
"That's really sexy," Jackson said.
"What?
This?"
She folded her legs back the other way.
"No.
When you bite your lip."
"Huh?"
She blinked.
"I didn't even realize. I do that in real life too, I guess. So, you like it?"
She bit her lip again and batted her eyelashes.
"Yeah. I do. What else do you like?"
"A lot of things," Jackson said. He walked up to the bed and pressed himself between her legs. He pushed her onto her back with a kiss. He raised himself back up and cupped her cheek.
"Just about everything. Would you say that I'm hot?"
"Yeah," Jackson said.
"Definitely. You want to fuck me?"
she whispered. The question was blunt, surprising. He found himself immensely turned on, but maybe they were the same. Playing in a dream, an endless masquerade, still wondering if their masks would fall off and it would all vanish. The thoughts only flashed for an instant. His body was flushed. His mind felt hazy. He didn't have any room left for self-doubt.
"Yeah,"
he growled. He kissed her neck and hissed the words.
"I want to fuck you."
Her legs wrapped around his waist. He explored her body with his lips, kissing her neck, her shoulders, her chin. He felt at the curve of her hips and her breasts. She arched her back, exposing herself to him as he ran his hands over her body.
"Take off your shirt,"
she said. Jackson stood. He pulled his shirt up over his head. It stuck on his elbow. He fought with it for a moment, then flung it off. When he looked back down, she was naked, except for a thin black thong. Her smile was back.
"You know there's an option for that in private rooms. Taking off clothes, I mean. I do now.
Heh." The dress had been revealing, but seeing her revealed was approaching a religious experience for him. Her body was perfectly proportioned. Her skin was smooth, flawless. She was perfectly symmetrical in a way only a computer could emulate, almost doll-like. She made a sexy pout with her lips.
"Like what you see?"
"Yes."
"So?"
She extended her foot and gently pressed it to the bulge in his pants.
"Do something about it."
He brushed her leg aside, leaned down, and kissed her naked breast. She groaned.
"Mmm."
Her flesh was soft in his mouth. He licked her nipple a few times, then let it fall from his lips. It hardened as he watched, the little nub rising up above tiny pink areola. He dove back down and licked, sucked, bit at it. It was salty, musky. He liked it. He moved to her other breast. He was more aggressive, sucking, using his teeth. She murmured encouragement. He tried taking as much of her breast as he could into his mouth, pulling the flesh with a hard suction, harder, before finally letting it snap back with a wet suckling sound. He felt a hand on his crotch. She was stroking him through his jeans. She gripped him tight until his erection formed a clear outline in his pants.
"I want that,"
she said.
"In me."
"Then why are you still wearing a thong?"
"Because I want you to take it off."
Jackson felt a slight nervousness as he undid his belt buckle. He hadn't modified anything down there. The options had been available, but it had seemed crass to even look at the genitals menu when he was designing his avatar. He hadn't exactly predicted this situation. He pulled his underwear and jeans down together. He was hard enough that his cock flicked out of his clothing. He glanced up at her, watching for a reaction. She bit her lip. Her neon eyes glowed. He felt a surge of confidence. He stepped out of his jeans and placed his hands on the string of her thong. She lifted her legs as he drew the cloth back over her thighs, then her ankles. And then they were both naked. He could see her pussy. Her vagina. It was small and tucked in. There was a trim brown patch of hair just above it.
"Put it in,"
she said.
"I want it in me."
He lowered himself over her. He didn't need an explanation. He slowly pushed the tip of his cock into her sex. That first penetration was almost frustrating. She couldn't take him very far. He could feel the warmth, a hot, wet softness tingling the tip of his cock. He wanted all of it. He drew back and pushed in again. She stretched a little further for him, wrapping up a good third of his length.
"Oh, shit."
Her hands clutched at the comforter.
"Fuck. Just slow at first. Please."
He drew back out, and then pushed back in. She felt hotter, and he got in farther. On his fourth slow stroke, he bottomed out inside of her. He inhaled as her heat engulfed him. She moaned.
"Fuck. Fuck, that's good. You're so fucking hard."
He drew back out most of the way, then plunged in again. She gave a muffled yelp. He did it again, then again, setting a steady rhythm. Her breasts quivered as his hips met hers.
"Oh, fuck yes. Fuck me like that. Get that big cock in me. Just like that."
Her stream of words urged him on. He kept it slow, full, and steady. Her ankles crossed behind his back, locking him close. She groaned as he bottomed out again. She grabbed her left breast and worked it in her hand. Taking that as a cue, he leaned down and took her right breast into his mouth as he slipped in and out of her.
"Ooh, yeah,"
she said. He felt her hands run through his hair.
"Suck on my nipple while you fuck me."
"Hmm." An idle thought drifted across his head. It was lucky he had a talkative partner. He didn't have to guess at what he was doing. He'd been so concerned with getting it right that he barely paid attention to himself, but now that needy burn was back. He could feel it building with each push into her pussy. Her hole was wet, slick, accepting. He could see the point in the distance when he wouldn't be able to hold back. It was getting close, fast.
"Fuck me harder,"
she said. He suckled on her breast on last time, then let it go so he could push into her harder. Her mewling turned into a high, short moan as he repeated the stroke. He shoved into her again, harder, faster. Her hips rocked against him, meeting his thrusts.
"Yeah, baby, moo shit. Fuck, you're so deep in me. Fuck me.
Faster.
Fuck me harder. Shit, yes. Fuck."
Her last shout morphed into a bestial groan. She was panting. A red blush bloomed across her skin. He was lost in the moment, pounding himself into her, driven by the pleasure building in his crotch as much as the words shouted at his ears. Their pace filled the room with a hard wet slap, slap, slap. Her breast shook every time he slammed into her. He leaned down again, and he was kissing at her chest, then her neck, half-biting, gnawing in a mindless sort of possessiveness. His toes worked for purchase on the carpet as he shoved into her again and again. He felt her nails rake his back. Her perfume wafted over him, mixed with the aroma of sex and sweat.
"Fuck me. Fuck me until I come. I'm gonna come, don't stop, don't stop, just like that, just like that."
His words were hard grunts.
"Me. Too. Come with me," she shouted. "Come inside me. Fuck me."
Her last me turned into a shriek. She transformed into a knot of tension, arching up, legs squeezing his back, nails scraping. He felt the tight walls of her sex flutter around his cock. That set him off. He growled something through his teeth. He buried himself into her, as deep as he could go, and came hard. He could feel his muscles clench up, release, clench again. He squeezed off bursts come into her until the spurts turned into a sluggish dribble. He fell over her, propping himself on his elbows so he didn't crush her. They were both heaving their breaths. They sat there for a time, breathing, slowly recovering from the high.
"Shit."
Sophia shifted her hips.
"Are you still hard?"
Jackson blinked. He was still inside her. He'd softened somewhat, but not that much.
"Yeah, mostly. All that for me? It's definitely for you."
She bit her lip, then licked it.
"Want to go again?"
That experience felt like it was a lifetime away. 3 months was a long time when you were 18. He was a lot more naive. He'd equated their one-night stand to love at first sight. He saw too much of himself in her. It was his first time. Maybe that was why he ascribed something special to their relationship, even though he had little basis to do so. He got emotional. He got invested. Sophia liked him, liked his attention, but she didn't want commitment. They hooked up a few more times, but he realized how shallow their relationship was when she started outright ignoring his messages. At first, that just made him cling harder. When she publicly rebuked him, in front of all his new friends, he got the message loud and clear. It turned out his bar buddies weren't much good for anything other than mooching drinks after he'd won a game. Once Sophia's female friends considered Jackson a pariah, none of them wanted anything to do with him. He became someone they knew from that one time, the creeper that didn't grasp the concept of a casual encounter. Ass backwards Jack, living in the sexual stone age. He deleted them all from his contacts list as a way of cutting it off. It was drastic, but they didn't want him around, and he didn't want to see them. It was a way to cauterize the wound. He didn't see Sophia again after that. It hurt. A lot of things did. It became just another one of those throbbing scars that every person accumulates, something to linger on in dark moments, but otherwise ignored. It was a lesson on life in the hub. Everything was fast-paced and twice as superficial. He became a sort of social drifter. He spent most of his time playing games for cash. He won much more than he lost, easily making a steady profit, besting the competition in everything from poker to go-kart racing. It was easy to keep a straight face when you were operating through a virtual avatar. That was money enough for groceries, utilities, amongst other things. He put the rest into his mutual funds. People would actually watch him play. Just from winning, he earned a group of followers. You could follow anyone in the hub, and you'd receive updates on what they were doing or playing, assuming they made it public, along with any status messages they posted. Jackson's settings on most things had been public by default, and after a string of victories, there was a crowd of regulars that started showing up to watch him play games. Privately, he thought that their lives must be awfully boring to watch him. Or hell, maybe he was better than he thought. The positive attention soothed his ego more than he cared to admit, so he didn't change his personal settings. But his first experience still rung in his ears. He avoided his little posse, spoke to them as little as possible. His antisocial behavior didn't turn them off. If anything, it made the crowd grow. He accidentally cultivated an atmosphere of being the strong, silent type that let his skill do the talking. He had a handful of sexual encounters, women that followed him from his games to the bars he frequented. He definitely enjoyed the sex, but all the girls started looking the same unblemished skin, the same vibrant eyes, the same perfect hair. When every woman was a supermodel, they were all equally boring. Sex became something he did to let off steam, not something he pursued out of boyish idealism. He'd go to drink quite often. His brain enjoyed it. It was a pleasing sensation, and it had no consequences. Virtual drinks were cheap, and if he really wanted to, he could tweak an option and shut down the effects instantly. Some people rigged up their own drinks, hard and soft mods that created the same effect. They were the virtual equivalent of moonshiners. Workarounds like that were heavily policed by the Dream's moderators and punishable via permanent bans and real-life prosecution. Just like Prohibition, the strict rules served to cultivate an underground modding community. Some of it was harmless fun, such as enabling graffiti on the normally invincible walls of buildings in the hub. Others were not so nice, stealing bitcoins from people in rigged games, ripping money straight from their accounts, or disguising themselves as others and conducting legal business in their stead. Jackson could understand why they kept a lid on it. Sure, stealing was illegal, but more importantly, the Dream Drive was as heavily regulated as the healthcare industry. New additions to the neural interface went through progressive stages of animal testing, much to the chagrin of PETA, and eventually withstood double-blind clinical trials with highly paid volunteers as the test subjects. Stories of people going into the trials and emerging with their brains microwave were rare, but it definitely happened. As per contract, the families were generously compensated in exchange for keeping quiet about the gory details. Any mods to the Dream Drive were considered a breach of contract and punishable by lifetime ban, as the modder was considered not only in violation of the law but a high-risk health hazard to himself but those around him. The wrong line of code could and did affect the mind. Particularly bad cases turned into poster children in the public campaign against modders. Jackson's heavy personal modifications to his helmet definitely qualified for punishment, but they were a lot harder to detect. Software mods could inevitably be recognized, because they had to change the virtual world directly in some fashion. Hard mods could simply be built so that they couldn't be detected. And he wasn't doing anything really bad, it was just to increase the power of his system, minimize lag. He was competent enough on the programming side, but he wouldn't dare touch the Dream's code. Sometimes he wondered why he told Sophia his name was John. He hadn't thought about it. It just came out. But in that experience, with the nervousness he was feeling, wouldn't he have just told her his real name? He combed over his memory, and that tiny flash of inspiration he'd had drifted back to him. He'd put up a fake name as a sort of mask. It was a defense mechanism. He'd rejected something very fundamental about the Dream. The hub was missing something essential. For all the people, all the games, all the events, corporations, celebrities, championships, food, drink, dance, music, art, you name it, the hub was fake. Perception is reality. That was the banner slogan of the Dream Drive. But knowing it wasn't real changed things. Dream Drive made most of their money by renting space in the hub. Downtown plots were more expensive, while newly created plots on the outskirts were cheap enough for private individuals to purchase. With a will and enough bitcoins, one could build a skyscraper that defied the laws of physics. But when you were surrounded by buildings as wild as yours, what was the point? Compared to the real world, you could have anything you wanted in the hub at an extremely low cost. You could build your dream home, you could purchase a virtual servant. The seedier places even offered custom programmed sex slave programs. A road packed with such institutions made up the hub's very own red light district. Jackson visited once, out of a sick kind of curiosity, and quickly resolved to never go back. There was energy in the hub, but it was empty calories literally. Virtual food tasted great, but the fullness only lasted for a few minutes for safety reasons. There was a thriving economy, a kaleidoscope of sight and sound, but it was papier-mâché over a wireframe of programming. It was devoid of what made humanity what it was: the fight. The conflict. The fierce struggle, the danger of risk, the afterglow of accomplishment. That was what it was missing. A sense of accomplishment. Was that all people were? When presented with all the resources in the world, did mankind just fuck off and play games? It was disappointing to watch. He wondered if this is what people felt like when the old internet was finally picking up steam, only to watch 90% of it devolve into pornography. The hub wasn't really all that great. But real life sucked a lot more, so Jackson made do. ISIS, though ISIS would be different. Dream Drive applications totally separate from the hub were still rare. The hub basically took care of everything you could want. It was a city and a casino rolled into one, and you could live right in the middle of it. Plenty of people used the drive to play video games, but that essentially turned their visor into a television screen. The first game made to take advantage of the Dream's full immersion was, of course, a first person. Against all expectations, it was a giant flop. It had been too realistic. People wanted to play a game, not actually get shot at. Jackson had played it a few times, and thought the realism was interesting, but he didn't find it all that much fun. ISIS was a new type of game, a totally standalone virtual world separated from the hub. It was a butt off the virtual bubble, its own unique space with its own rules. ISIS was an RPG, an MMORPG, to be precise, a massive multiplayer online role-playing game. It was being made by the game development company, Crux. When Jackson heard that, he got goosebumps. The president of Crux was Emil Mohamed, a man of Arab and French descent with his headquarters in the United States. He was a genius of game design. Against the will of his shareholders, he insisted that ISIS not be available on any other device or console. After the failure of the first-person shooter genre, long considered a money-printing machine on every platform, many were concerned about the ability to create a good, standalone game in virtual space. Contrary to that concern, Emil wanted himself and his team totally focused on the Dream Drive. His stated goal, fully and totally transport his players into a fantasy world. Jackson felt an instinctual kinship with Emil. He was the only hub presence that Jackson followed. The man was a giant of industry, a master of, in a word, fun. Jackson had played all 17 games published by Crux since Emil had founded his company after dropping out of college. Most of them were RPGs. They were all some of the best games Jackson had ever played. Emil was notoriously public in all his interactions. He was charismatic and bombastic. People called him the Tony Stark of video games. He was everything Jackson was, and everything he was and everything he couldn't be. Isis had been in development for 5 years, starting just 1 year after the Dream Drive came out. It was more or less the reason Jackson bothered with the thing in the first place. 5 years was a long time for any game, but considering the amount of work they had to do, it wasn't too unreasonable. The team they'd put together for the project was legendary in size and scope, thousands of programmers, artists, designers. It was the single biggest investment for any video game ever. The amount of hype being generated was insane, almost to the point of making Jackson suspicious. The trailer, though. When he saw the trailer, he understood why people were treating this as something different. Jackson had seen the trailer online. It was rather tame, more or less a slideshow of fantasy vistas set to music. In the dream, he'd heard it was a totally different experience. After that first night with Sophia, he'd downloaded it from the hub market, where it was freely available. He was transported from one of the hub's many city squares and onto a hill. Rich green grass covered the ground. The air smelled like springtime. He could feel the humidity sitting on his skin. The sky was cloudy. Down the hill, a few miles away, there was a long, lazy river, and past that, a massive tree. It was the biggest tree he'd ever seen, taller than the hill he stood on, as tall as a mountain. The branches leapt into the sky as if the clouds were its leaves. Here and there, where the sky was blue, he could see that the tree continued to spread higher. At the base of the giant's trunk, there was a city, nestled in a ring around nature's leviathan. The buildings looked like toy houses at this distance. He could see the pointed roofs of church belfries, the crenellations of watchtowers.
"This is my world. Isis."
Jackson turned. Standing next to him, wearing the navy robes of some sort of wizard, was none other than Emil Muhammad himself. The man's ink-black hair was splayed down his head. He had a salt-and-pepper beard. He looked at Jackson with gray eyes.
"Let me show you."
Emil raised a hand. A pale green orb formed around himself and Jackson. It floated them up and off the ground, and they soared down the hill. The water in the river was tossed back as they rushed forward. Their bubble blasted through the gates of the city and down a brick road. People jumped out of the way as they flew by. A horse reared up, stopping the carriage it was pulling. The townsfolk pointed and shouted. They flew up to the fortress that ringed the very base of the tree trunk, and then over the wall, and up, up the tree. He could feel the pressure on his cheeks as their bubble accelerated. He glanced over his shoulder. The ground was rapidly shrinking behind them.
"Let me show you!"
Emil shouted. They punctured the cloud line. White fog blocked Jackson's sight. Water collected on his skin. He closed his eyes and wiped his face, and then, Jackson was above the clouds, floating, drifting in a blinding blue sky. Branches like roads twined around him. Huge leaves stood out from the branches like ferns. He drifted down and settled onto his feet. Thick rivulets of bark jutted up into his shoes. A lone wind made the giant leaf next to him creak and shift. Emil was gone. Jackson heard metal sliding on metal. He looked in the direction of the sound. An angel was hovering nearby. It had no mouth. A red halo floated above its head. It was wearing shining armor. It had two great, feathered wings, but they didn't flap to keep it aloft. It had just drawn its sword. Its words resounded inside Jackson's head. "You should not have come here." The angel exploded forward, sword ready. Jackson flung his hands up. He reeled back and sat down on asphalt, breathing. He was back in the hub, back in the city. A little prompt asked him if he wanted to replay the trailer. Jackson stood. He felt like a live wire. He clenched his fists.
"Holy shit!"
He smacked the replay button.
"Hey, Jack! Jackie!"
Jackson's eyes popped open. He'd fallen asleep at his desk, head propped on his Dream Drive helmet. He drooled on it a bit. He peeled his cheek off the plastic and sat straight. He glanced out his window. He had a marvelous view of a cement apartment block 2 feet away, but a dim hint of sunlight told him that at least a few hours had gone by. The tiny alley out his window wasn't attractive, but it was good enough as an improvised clock. The doorbell rang. His mother yelled again.
"Jackie! The doorbell! Jackie! Are you wearing that fucking helmet again?"
Jackson hated the nickname Jackie. His mother seemed to have this odd and insistent idea that using it offered her some sort of parental advantage over him. She tended to grasp for it whenever she wanted him to do something. He got up from his chair, walked into the hall, careful to lock his room behind him. He didn't used to lock his room, but his mother started baiting him out so she could snag and pawn off his computer equipment. She would do anything to feed her addiction, even steal from her own son. So, now he locked his room. The hallway was dusty. One of the lights had burned out. The hardwood floor was marked and scraped in places. There was a crumpled up newspaper where the hall met the living room. The living room itself was in a lot worse shape. Plates with half-eaten food were lying here and there. The scent of stale beer leaked from a collection of open containers. Clothes were tossed here and there. His mother was lying on the couch, rubbing her face. Her hair, blonde hair, was frazzled from being ground into the cushions. Somewhere behind the stress lines and the crow's feet was a rather pretty woman determined to ruin herself with cigarettes and alcohol.
"Jackie!
Mom!
I'm right here!
Jesus!
She cracked her eyes open. Get the fucking door. The doorbell rang again, a blaring, droning sound. Jackson walked the 10 feet and opened the door. A uniformed man, wearing an expression that said I don't want to be here, was waiting for him with a brown package. Delivery for Vidalt.
That's me.
Hey, what if it's for me? His mother shouted.
What is it?
It's just a video game, Mom.
Let me see it.
The man raised an eyebrow and offered Jackson a flat pad.
I need a signature.
Yep. Jackson tucked the package under his arm and scrawled out his name.
Have a good one.
You too. The man shut the door behind him.
Let me see it.
Jackson bit his tongue and went to the kitchen. The closet-sized space reeked, mostly from the sink. It was piled high with dishes, most of which were still coated with crusty food. He was glad he'd replaced the vent filters leading to his room with higher quality stuff. He didn't want to be breathing that dot. He slit the package open with a knife. A small white paper was folded outside of some bubble wrap. He opened it up. Jackson Vidalt, thank you for competing in the Crux Top Gamer Championship. For making it into the quarterfinals, you've won an early release copy of our new game, Isis, on the day before the beta goes live. The servers are already up and running, so feel free to hop right in. I hope you enjoy the world I've created, sincerely. Emil Muhammad under the man's printed name was his signature. Jackson licked his finger and slid it across the ink. It smeared. Emil Muhammad had signed this personally. Jackson decided he'd probably framed the letter. The Top Gamer Championship had been alright, but Jackson had quit after making the quarterfinals. He was only interested in Isis. He'd gotten a tidal wave of disappointed messages from his hub followers. He did what he usually did, deleted all of them.
Jackie, are you deaf?
I'm coming. Jackson went back to the living room. His mother hadn't moved. He took off some of the bubble wrap and showed his mother the package.
It's the special edition of Isis. It's a MMORPG for the computer. You go into a fantasy world and fight people with swords and magic. The rumor is that the magic isn't anything like it is in other games, though. In most games, it's just pushing buttons, and then you have to wait a while until you can cast again. This game is different. I was on a forum the other day, and apparently some people think dash.
Alright, alright. His mother waved him off.
I get the point. By the way, the kitchen reeks.
I noticed.
You gonna clean it?
No.
You're 18. You think I can't kick you out?
Clean the sink.
You won't kick me out.
I will if you don't listen to me.
It's your turn.
Jack said.
I told you that 3 months ago. I'll help with the chores, but we're taking turns. If you want things clean, then clean them. I'll do it the time after that.
Jackson turned and walked away. He heard her turn on the television. He used to be afraid of his mother, but as he got older and bigger, his fear turned into apathy. That, and she couldn't hit him without getting a harder hit back. He could probably move out. He had the cash. But he was afraid of leaving her alone. She hadn't always been like this. She changed when Dad died. She buried the grief in alcohol and sex. He tried to snap her out of it. He tried to ignore the stream of men that stayed over on weekends, and increasingly, weekdays. He encouraged her to drink in the dream drive, rather than reality. She just told him it wasn't the same. Jackson decided that he could either spend his life worrying about her, or stop caring. So he stopped caring. Maybe that made him a bad person. He wasn't sure. On the return trip to his room, he noticed a used condom on the floor. That was beyond disgusting. He gave it a wide berth and retreated into his sanctuary. He shut the door and locked it behind him. He felt human again. Fresh, filtered air. Everything neat and tidy. Well, his desk could use some work, but the rest of the room was done up. 7 days until high school started again. 7 days with nothing to do but play Isis. The two short trailers were the only thing that had been released to preview Isis in 5 years. The online community had analyzed them to hell and back, hunting for clues. People had come up with wild theories about the plot, the world, and the angel with the red halo. Another major camp which Jackson was a part of had decided that speculation was entertaining, but relatively pointless. The trailers were just a demonstration of the game, and they'd been released in year 2 of development, so things had probably changed since then anyway. The massive team working on the game had remained conspicuously silent. It wasn't unusual for leaks to emerge about video games and progress both planned and unplanned, but the dead silence from Crux was very odd. Everyone figured that Emil had them sign ironclad legal agreements, but no one could confirm or deny, so it was all speculation. Jackson brought his helmet over to the bed. The fiber optic cable to his computer plenty long enough to reach. He extracted the game's case from the bubble wrap. The cover art was from the trailer, an image of the massive tree. A tiny stamp in the corner marked the game as AO Adults Only. He began the battle that every video game enthusiast knows well, getting the game out of the damn case. His fingernails scraped and picked uselessly at the plastic wrapping. Eventually, he had to resort to using his teeth. He tore the wrapper off, removed the strips of factory tape, and popped it open. There was no insert. His special edition goodies, still back in the package, took the place of that. All that rested within the hard plastic was a single black data chip. The chip was marked by an inverted red pentagram. Beneath that, spelled in cursive, was the word Isis. Jackson pressed a button on his drive. A small port on the top slid open. He inserted the chip and pushed the port closed. The game wasn't on the chip itself. He'd need an optical memory block the size of the entire apartment block for that. His chip was an encrypted access code to the Crux servers, and it doubled as a backup for his personal information in the case of any problems. He'd started spouting to his mother about inane details on Isis's magic system on purpose. When he was little, he'd tell her about his video games, and she'd stop listening to him and do something else. That hurt, at first, but it became a way to fend her off when he was too small to do much else. Much more powerful than love or hate was the raw force of apathy, but the pentagram had him wondering. There was a rumor that magic in the game would rely on runes powered through certain collectibles. The symbol on the chip definitely fit that theory. He'd find out for himself soon enough. He slid the helmet on his head and lay back on his pillow. It was actually a size big they all were. Actuated pistons locked the helmet into place on his skull, forming a soft inner sheath that conformed to his personal dimensions. A confirmation message asked if he wanted to enter the dream drive. Jackson spoke one word. Yes. His world went dark, and then lit up. He was standing on a pure white field once more, on the main menu of the dream. Normally, there was a single square in front of him, the image of the hypercity known as the hub. Now, there were two squares. The second option was the silhouette of a tree on a red background. A red pentagram was etched into the tree trunk. Black words above the small portrait stated the name of the game. Jackson punched the word Isis. The world went black again. A glowing red sentence lit the darkness. Connecting to Cruise Games server. Connected. Welcome, Jackson Vidal. He was back in white space. Only now, Emil Muhammad, dressed in his robes, was standing in front of him. Hello there, Jackson. Jackson wasn't sure what to do. Hi. Thanks for competing in the tournament. I'm a pre-recorded message from Emil Muhammad. Oh. The hologram of Emil continued to speak. I wanted to personally introduce the quarterfinalists to the game. By the way, I was surprised you quit. I'd put money down on you. That doesn't matter to me much, but was looking forward to the game. Jackson realized the message was customized for him, personally. That meant Emil Muhammad had taken time out of his schedule to address one Jackson Vidal as a single individual. He wanted to jump for joy. I looked on your hub profile out of curiosity. You've got a lot of followers. Seeing your game history got me thinking. I realized you didn't care about the tournament. I have a feeling that you only cared about Isis. Was he that obvious? Or was Emil just that insightful? His respect for the man was on the verge of jumping the gap from reverence to full idol worship. Well, Emil continued. That makes two of us. You see, reality kinda stinks. I mean, it's alright. But it's crappy. You know this, I know this, the world knows it. That's why we bothered making a dream drive. That's why we built the hub for ourselves. It's an escape. But it's no escape at all, is it? The hub isn't much better than reality. It's reality version 1.1. I had to go beyond the hub, beyond normal games. I had to make an entirely new reality, a reality so good it was a sequel to the original. A reality so real, so encompassing, so much better that you would watch the old one burn just to stay in the new. A reality that is powerful, gripping. Something that seizes your heart and never lets go. That's the kind of world I envision. The hologram turned and looked straight at Jackson. I have made that world. Or rather, I'm making it still. All good things take time. But we're well on our way. Your avatar in the hub probably doesn't look much like your real self. Let me ask you a favor. Don't be fake. Don't disrespect Isis like that. Put yourself in the game as you really are, and play the game as you want to play. Do you want to gain power and become a warlord, a king? Do it. Do you want to become a knight that fights for truth, justice, and the American way? Do it. Go where your heart leads. This is a second chance. Take it. But be yourself. He nodded. Do that for me, and you'll be happy you did. I promise you that. He sighed. The other players will get a similar message. Not just the finalists in the tournament, either, but every player will be asked to keep themselves as they are. Not by me, personally, but you get the idea. I'm trying to build something together with all of you. This is our second chance, our second wind. We've screwed up Earth badly enough, right? This man, he got it. He understood. He was a visionary. Jackson felt ready to follow him wherever he would lead. Isis is not a fairy tale world, Emil said. It is not a typical online game. Prepare yourself. What you do can and will matter, but if you want to change things, you must change them. So go out and get to it. And who knows? We might see each other around. Emil gave him a jaunty wave. Good luck. Emil vanished. Jackson was greeted with a character creation screen. An image of himself floated in the air, slowly rotating. It wasn't much to look at. He was 6 feet, but scrawny, almost bone thin. His skin was as pale as the white background. His sand-colored hair was forever in a state of bedheadedness. The default was to keep his real appearance. Alternatively, he could customize his avatar. He immediately gestured toward the default option. A dialogue box asked him if he was sure he wanted to keep everything the same. Jackson nodded, and the box closed, locking in his decision. The world went black. You are hereby sentenced to banishment at the base of the tower. Do you have any last words? Jackson opened his eyes. Wind whipped past him. He was stripped naked. He clutched at himself. He was standing on the end of a long wooden plank. The platform extended over a pit dug in the ground. The bottom of the pit held a rotating field of black light. A man draped in a red tabard was standing at the edge of the platform, the part that led back to solid ground. A broad mustache dominated his face. His clothing was etched with an image of the giant tree. He was backed by several heavily armored guards.
What is this? Where am I?
The man cocked an eyebrow. His mustache bobbed as he spoke.
You're a star-marked slave. You're being banished. Do you have any last words?
I'm surprised you actually answered him. One of the guards muttered. They tend to panic when they're at the threshold. Mustache replied.
Lose sense of themselves. I've seen it before. Still, one last kindness before death. It costs me nothing.
Mustache faced Jackson again.
You there, slave. I'll record your last words. Keep a straight spine. This is for the good of us all.
What? Jackson tried to think.
Why am I being banished?
You're star marked. The man raised his left hand and pointed at it. He repeated the words.
Star. Marked.
Jackson looked at his left hand. Inscribed on the back of his flesh was a pentagram. It wasn't a neat tattoo, it looked like it had been cut into his skin. It wasn't the normal pink sheen of scar tissue either, but blackened, twisted, as if it was some sort of infection. It stretched from his knuckles to his wrist.
So, I have to be banished because I'm marked?
Why?
Because it is written.
Mustache replied.
How was I marked? Did someone do this to me?
You do it to yourselves in your sleep. The man said.
And then it grows back with that black color. You're tainted. I'm sorry it has to be this way, but that's how it is. I'll give you a moment, boy.
Wait a second. I'm being banished to the bottom of a tower?
Where are we now?
The top? One of the guards sighed.
Just tip him in. Let him be a man while he can.
Another said.
I've got better things to do than officiate a funeral.
Silence. Mustache barked. All the guards immediately stiffened and snapped their mouths closed.
Boy. Make your jump.
Jackson looked down at the swirling black light. This was a game. It was just the intro to the game. The cold wind battering his body, on the other hand, felt extremely real. He prepared himself to jump. He could jump, right? Or he could do better. It was just a game. He could do anything. He sprinted full on down the platform. His bare feet slapped the wood as he ran as fast as he could. He wobbled once, almost fell, kept going.
Sorry, kid. Don't hate us.
One of the guards flipped a lever. The platform detached from the rim of the pit. Jackson fell. The platform struck the side of the pit below him and entered swirling blackness. He followed a moment after. Jackson woke to the sound of dripping water. He sat up. It was dim. Moisture-slick stone walls led off in either direction to his left and right. A pool of scummy water had collected a few feet away from him. As he watched it, another plink of water made it ripple. The air smelled like mold. The cold of the stone was settling into his skin. He picked himself up off the tunnel floor. As he got to his feet, words flashed in front of him. Welcome to Isis. Your health is displayed by a red bar in the upper right-hand corner. You can access the game menu by saying game menu at any time. A red bar was sitting in the corner of his vision. Either he hadn't noticed it before, or it had just got there. He cleared his throat.
Game menu.
A slightly translucent screen appeared in front of him, hanging in midair. On one half of the screen was his avatar, looking at him with a neutral expression. He'd expected empty boxes spots where he could put equipment, but he didn't see anything. The right half of the screen was just blank. At the bottom were a few numbers, and underneath them was an options button, and another button that read skill trees. Carry weight 0.00/35.00%, health 50.00/50.00, status effects none. He tried the options button first. The only thing that came up was the ability to quit the game. He tried it, experimentally. A smaller box with red text flashed in front of him. Warning, if you log off without secure shelter, your avatar will remain behind for 30 seconds. During this time, you will be completely vulnerable. Think carefully before taking this risk. That was a dangerous level of persistence. If he quit the game in middle of nowhere, a monster could come up and kill him. Or hell, another player could kill him. He didn't know anything about player-on-player combat, so he had to assume the worst. Come to think of it, he had no idea what would happen if he died. He'd be alone for a little while. Jackson had signed on to be in the beta, but so did millions of other people. Crux was only taking 5,000, chosen by random lottery. Jackson didn't like those odds, so he'd ensured he'd get a copy through the top gamer contest. He'd quit early, foregoing his scheduled match so that he could play Isis. He might be the very first person in the game. He cancelled his logout and tapped the skill tree button. Another box opened in front of him, this time asking him if he wanted to view active or passive skills. He hit the active panel. It was entirely blank. He closed the active skills box by hitting an X in the corner, then opened the passive skill box. There was a single tab that showed an image of a man's running feet. It was labeled sprinting. He tapped it. Yet another box opened. Sprinting, run at high speeds. Skill level affects maximum speed and duration. Modifiers, vit, agi, level, 1 progress, 0.13%. Alright. So the only skill he'd used was the only skill that showed up. Maybe trying different things would fill in the gaps. He assumed that the 0.13% was from his escape attempt. But this was neat. If he ran a lot, he'd get better at running. Made sense. He wondered how good at running he could get. He wasn't very athletic. Hell, he couldn't remember the last time he'd sprinted in real life. But would he cap out at Olympics levels of running? Or could he go further, and the bit at the end modifiers? Vit and agi. Jackson had played a lot of games, and he recognized the shortened version of those statistics immediately: vitality and agility. So, he did have stats, and they affected his performance, even if he couldn't see them. At least, for the moment. Close menu. The layers of boxes and screens vanished. A moment later, more floating blue words scrawled themselves in front of him. You are a slave to angels. You work to build the next level of the Tower, Babel. Human generations have been born and died before a single level of Babel has been completed, but the angels have an eternity to wait. It is written that the Starmarked pose a grave danger to the angels and normal humans. Such cursed individuals, marked by darkness, are banished to the base of the Tower. The Tower is vast. Its breadth was made great, and its height must be still greater. The angels built themselves cities in which to live upon each level, as did the humans. Those humans left behind when one level was completed created their own cities, countries, and civilizations. Some thrived, while others died. Some scraped together what they could from the ruins of those that came before. Perhaps some have forgotten from whence they came. Powerful magics coursed through the Tower, remnants of the passing angels, their artifacts and guardians, their essence forged into the walls and rocks. Magic unchecked gives rise to things both great and terrible. For magic is the power of change, and change begets change. And change, well, change can be good, and it can be bad. The text vanished. He glanced up and down the tunnel. The water kept dripping. He was alone, naked, and relatively helpless. If he was going to survive, he needed a weapon. Jackson picked a direction at random and started walking.
Chapter 02.
Jackson saw the first rat after he'd been walking for a few minutes. A faint squeak, a flicker in the darkness. The flash of a tail. The tunnel was dim, but there was enough light to see. There was a sort of ambient blue glow that hazed through the air. He wasn't sure where it was coming from. The sheen of the walls, slicked with water, reflected enough of it for him to keep his bearings. He came across a four-way intersection. His three new options all looked identical, weathered, cracked slate, marbled over with moss. He hesitated. He was still naked. He had nothing to mark where he'd been. His feet were getting cold. That gave him an idea. There was a thin layer of moldy slime underfoot. He dragged his toes through it, pushing it aside. It created a clear patch on the stone that marked the entrance to the passage he'd just come from. This game was amazing. Jackson hadn't seen much of Isis yet. Hell, all he'd done was walk down this tunnel bare as the day he was born. It was already the most incredible game he'd ever played. It didn't have the fake neon sheen of the hub. It was gritty. It was real. He could feel that mold on the bottom of his feet, squishy, stuck between his toes. It made him shiver, and he could smell it, too. The damp, dead air that hadn't moved for years. He trailed his fingertips along one wall. He could feel the bumps and creases in the stone under a film of water. The only thing telling him he was really in virtual reality was the red health bar in the upper right corner of his eyesight. It was currently full. The spoken command game menu would open up more options, but otherwise, he was totally on his own. He turned to the right and kept walking. He heard another squeak. More rats. Well, it was just a game. What were they going to do, bite him? He reached a door. The wooden planks were rotted out around the edges. It looked about to fall apart. He could smell something on the other side, something nastier than mold. Jackson creaked it open. He froze. The floor inside was littered with distinctly human skeletons. The corners of the room were piled high with bones. Some of them still had bits of meat or gristle sticking to them. He put a hand over his nose. There was another squeak, and another. Jackson looked over. One of the bone piles was crawling with rats. He immediately considered doing a 180. Something stopped him. Through the canyon of bones, there was another door, set into the opposite wall. The hint of flickering orange light darted under the wood slats. He wasn't entirely sure he wanted to know what was on the other side. But this was an adventure, right? What did he have to lose? He approached the door. He could hear a muffled sound on the other side. He opened it slowly, trying to avoid making a creak. There was a fire pit on one side of the room, set deep in the stone. It had burned down to hot coals. Hunched over a nearby table was something gnashing its teeth over a fat hunk of meat. Jackson could see a long tail protruding from the thing's backside. Its feet were paws. Flickers of light betrayed a long, blood-smeared snout and wicked fangs. Bristled fur covered its body. It looked like it was wearing rags. The smell and the disgusting sounds of the ratman digging in made his stomach flip. It picked its current bone clean and tossed it over its shoulder. It clattered into the pile. It used its knife to cut another segment of human from the half-eaten leg on the table, then began to feast again. It hadn't noticed him yet. It was fixated on the meal. Jackson was about to get the hell out of there when he saw the spear. It was across the room from him, past where the creature was sitting. Firelight gleamed off its point. Next to it was a wooden shield and scattered bits of leather armor, most of it shredded. He spotted a dagger near the spear, too. He weighed the risks. He'd been banished, naked, into this ancient stone maze at the bottom of what was apparently the Tower of Babel. He could go back and try another path, but this wasn't a nice place. Sooner or later he'd run into something nasty again. He dashed forward. The thing grunted as he ran past. Wood scraped on stone as it pushed back its chair. Jackson decided that the spear was not for close quarters. He slid down and snatched up the dagger. By the time he'd gotten a grip on the back of the shield, the creature was facing him. Sharp yellow nails lined its hands. It snarled at him, then ran forward. Before it reached him, it threw the bit of meat it was holding. Jackson blocked the projectile with his shield, but he didn't see the rat man's other hand. It flashed into its rags and came out with a dagger. The weapon plunged into Jackson's stomach. Jackson's health bar dropped a wide notch. The creature's spittle-filled growl rolled over his face. It twisted the dagger. The health bar started grinding down at a steady rate. Jackson was more surprised than anything. The blade currently puncturing his body felt like a strong, very uncomfortable pinch. Definitely not something he wanted, but not so bad. Jackson casually raised his hand and plunged his own dagger into the rat's neck. It made a sort of gurgled shriek, then fell back. It twisted on the floor in pain. Its hands quivered over the wound, trying to stem the flow of blood. It clearly hadn't expected him to counter. Most people probably dropped after a dagger in the gut. Jackson reached down and pulled the weapon out of himself. His health bar stopped dropping. It was still 3/4 full. He checked where the curved dagger had been. There was no wound, no indication that he'd ever been stabbed. He stretched his stomach. No lingering pain either. Aside from the hit to his health, he was unharmed. The creature was still twitching. Jackson set his daggers down and grabbed the spear. The weight felt good in his hands. He lined up the tip, then jabbed it into the rat. The game did not spare him the brutality of his act. Where the spear struck, the rat's flesh ripped open. He stabbed again, tearing a larger hole in the creature's abdomen. Its organs burst onto the ground. He jabbed it again in the chest, and it stopped moving. Jackson wiped his forehead with the back of his hand. He was still cold, but he was sweating. He'd never sweat like that back in the hub. Isis was different. He ripped his eyes off the creature's innards. The smell of decaying flesh was still hanging in the room. It felt like he'd really killed something. He really had killed something. He wanted to throw up. White mist rose out of the rat man's corpse. Jackson's eyes widened. The mist collected into a white orb, then rushed toward him. Jackson tried to jump out of the way, but it changed direction and struck him on the back, as if magnetized to his body. He stood there, waiting for the curse of the rat to take him. Nothing happened. No. Something was different. Underneath his health bar was a new indicator. Essence, 6. Inch game menu. Jackson said. The menu popped into view. His pale as a sheet self was now holding a spear and shield in a neutral position. The spear was labeled rusty iron-tipped spear. The shield labeled old wooden slat shield. He tried tapping the spear. An expanded view of the weapon appeared in the formerly blank right-hand field. A small description appeared under the weapon. An old spear with a rusty iron tip and a cracked wooden shaft, approximately 6 feet in length. It was found amongst a few other weapons and a ruined set of armor, all that remained of a Radix meal. Rune slots. 2 durability. Low under the heading rune slots were 2 black boxes. There were lines drawn from the boxes to the picture of the weapon. One indicated the shaft of the spear, and the other was lined up with the tip. If a rune was a magic spell, that meant he could place 2 enchantments on the spear. Unfortunately, he didn't know how to use magic at the moment. Maybe it had something to do with essence? The item description told him something he didn't know. Apparently the thing he'd slain was called a Radix. He immediately started reading all the other descriptions. The rest of his items didn't give him much more, but he did confirm that the Radix were vile creatures that cannibalized even their own kind. They sounded pretty much like the generic RPG bad guy, the kind players could slaughter in droves without worrying about silly things like moral ramifications. Wondering if anything else had changed, he pressed the skill tree button. The active skill panel was still blank, but the passive skill panel now had 4 boxes. The first was the same as before sprinting. The 3 new boxes were labeled daggers, spears, and shields. Like his sprinting skill, they all had progress bars. Assumedly, by using one of the objects repeatedly, he could increase his skill in the respective field. That was great, but he wasn't sure how it would happen. So far everything he did was under his own power. He ran as fast as he could in real life. He grew winded at the same pace. He stabbed as hard as he could stab. Would getting better with spears make him magically stab harder? Or would he actually become more skillful? Well, he was a beta player, and the only person in the entire game for the moment. He'd have to figure it out himself. He opened his mouth to speak, but something caught his eye. There was a new symbol near the image of his avatar. The door creaked. Jackson looked up. A Radix was standing on the other side of the room. It stared at him, took in the corpse of its companion, then looked back at him. Close menu, Jackson said. The Radix lunged forward. Jackson stabbed with the spear, but he telegraphed his intentions too clearly. The Radix dodged, batted the shaft aside, and came in with a claw. Jackson raised his shield. The Radix's nails raked the wood. A half second later, it slammed into the shield bodily. Jackson stumbled, but kept the shield between himself and his assailant. The Radix flailed wildly, trying to get a claw around the wooden slats. Jackson dropped his spear and grabbed the shield with both hands. It turned into a shoving match. Jackson was sliding backwards. The Radix was bigger than him, and stronger. He gave ground to stop himself from losing his balance. The shield buckled in his grip as the Radix striked it. A corner of the wood was torn away. His back hit a wall. The Radix shoved forward again. Jackson's head struck the stone. It didn't hurt much, but his health bar dropped slightly. The Radix beat at the shield with both arms. The hammer blows drove Jackson down onto a knee. The Radix claws scraped the shield, his arm, and shoulder, the side of his neck. His red lifeline slipped lower and lower under the rain of attacks. He needed to get out of this situation. He tried to shove back up, but the Radix easily overpowered him, keeping its height advantage. Jackson slid back on one knee to avoid the next clawing attack, but the flat of his foot crunched into bone. He had no more space to give. Bone. Jackson looked at his ankle. A long rib poked at his leg. He dropped a hand from his shield and reached for it. The Radic was able to shove his shield aside. Jackson took another blow to his health bar, a direct slash to the side of his head. He grit his teeth and ignored the paper-cut stinging sensation that needled his skin. He turned to face the Radic again, still on one knee. The monster's eyes were wide. It was slavering, breathing heavily. Was it tired? Jackson gathered his strength. He put his back into it and roared, shoving his shield into the Radic's face with everything he had. The monster put his hands up to fend off the blow, but Jackson was off the ground. He threw himself onto the creature. It was a lot stronger than him, but it couldn't do much about his full weight all at once. Jackson's health bar took a few more small hits for his trouble as the creature struggled to get him off, but he'd been counting on that. Taking hits to his health didn't slow him down. He couldn't be injured. All he had to do was get close. He jammed the rib bone into the Radic's chest. It punctured the hairy skin. He pushed the part that stuck out with the heel of his palm. The Radic shrieked. Jackson kept slamming the bone with his hand, twisting it back and forward, driving it in deeper. The Radic collapsed to the ground, carrying Jackson with him. They were a tangle of nails and fists and feet. Jackson's hand touched a shield. It had fallen off his arm in the confusion. He grabbed the wooden plank as he kicked himself free of the monster. He got to his feet, then jumped on top of the Radic, slamming both feet right where the rib was lodged in its abdomen. The Radic's cry came out as a wet cough. He knocked the wind out of it. Jackson lowered himself down, straddling the monster. He raised his shield and slammed the thin edge into the creature's throat. He did that again, and again, crushing its windpipe into its neck. When that was done, he started smashing the shield into its face, battering it into the stone. His vision turned red. He felt like he was floating somewhere, watching himself. He beat the Radic into the floor, smashing it into the rock until his arms burned and ached. "You have created a new skill, Shield Bash." He sat back. His breath came in heaving gasps. His bare skin was covered in blood. He gripped his shield so hard his fingers hurt. What he'd just done finally started to hit him. He crawled up off the Radic's corpse. He turned the creature's snout to bloody white pulp. An orb of white light rushed out of the Radic and into him. His essence ticked up to the number 13. He slid away until his was huddled against the wall. This was just a game, right? Just a game. A game. Deep breath. What do you need to focus on? Health. His heath down dangerously low. He checked out the menu. He was at about 6/50. He stood up. He could move around freely with the menu open. He didn't want to be near the beaten corpse of the rat. He glanced back at the new part of the menu he hadn't had a chance to investigate. There was an inverted pentagram at the bottom of his image, near the options and skill tree buttons. He pressed it. The pentagram expanded to fill his view. Each of the 5 points was labeled with a different attribute. Strength, vitality, agility, compulsion, persuasion, spirit. The caressing reassurance of raw mathematics flowed over him. Yes, this was a game, an RPG, and here were his statistics. He could handle this. He'd played games with gore. The gore had never been coating his own hands, but he tried to relegate that fact into the mental bin of minor details. He tapped each one of the statics with his finger. A brief description appeared, along with a slider to supply each attribute with essence, if he so chose. Strength, physical strength. Strike harder, jump higher, and carry great burdens. Vitality, stamina, and health. Increase your health bar. Shrug off physical status effects. Agility, speed, and dexterity. Run faster, react more quickly, and manipulate complex weapons with more skill. Compulsion, the compulsive power of runes. Force the world to bend to your whim. Persuasion, the persuasive power of runes. Convince the world that your way is better. Spirit sense, and use essence more efficiently. Resist the effects of magic. Hold more essence at once. Jackson considered his options. He had 13 essence. He could put as much as he wanted into each category. At the moment, it seemed his biggest advantage was not actually receiving debilitating injuries when he was struck. The Radic didn't expect that he was an anomaly. He was star-marked. They were stuck playing by real-world rules. He had a health bar. There was a second consideration, as well. This early, it wouldn't matter, but going forward, he'd have to pick a role. Jack-of-all-trades types didn't do well in role-playing games. There was a reason players grouped up to tackle bigger challenges. Each person had their specialty. Some were frontline damage takers, the tanks. Others were speedy damage dealers, rogues, assassins. Other players served as healers, or cast powerful spells from the back lines magicians. Magic looked like it was shaping up to be a little complicated. The spirit attribute suggested that there was a maximum amount of essence he could hold at once. For now, he needed to press his advantage and ensure that none was wasted. He dumped 10 essence into vitality and 3 into strength. He closed the pentagram screen. His health had jumped to 18.5/62.5, which told him his health had increased 12.5 points in exchange for 10 essence. Good to know. His carry weight had gone up too. Now it was maxed out at 35.75. That meant a quarter point for each essence put in strength. He suspected that the ratios might change as he advanced less gains for the same amount, but at least he finally had some hard numbers. Jackson liked numbers. Numbers were solid. They never lied. They distracted him from the fact that Radic blood was drying on his naked skin. He remembered what had flashed in front of his eyes when the battle was ending a new skill. Shield Bash. He opened his skill tree. Lo and behold, his first active skill was there. Shield Bash. Slam a foe with your shield to knock them back. Requires a shield. Level, 1 essence cost, 10 progress, 23.4%. Shit. Jackson muttered. His active skills took essence to activate. A strong bash at the right time could easily decide a fight. If he'd known that beforehand, he wouldn't have spent everything so quickly. He had to keep moving. He had his shield, somewhat battered and splattered from the last encounter, and his spear. He didn't have any way to carry the two daggers. He took a look at the leather armor in the corner. Most of it was shredded, probably by Raddock claws. On closer inspection, he found that it wasn't leather, but a sort of dried, toughened hide. The leggings were relatively intact. They were too big for his waist, and rode high on his heels, but it was better than nothing. A hide belt solved one of those problems, and it gave him a place to stick his two daggers. He had blood smeared all over his torso, he was over half dead, his clothes were too short and definitely not his style, and he was somewhere in a dark, rat creature infested maze at the bottom of the Tower of Babel. But at least he wasn't naked anymore. Like it usually did, Jackson's luck came in a wave. The second Raddock must have been fetching water before it attacked him. A bucket of the stuff was sitting right inside the next doorway. He realized he was thirsty. He wasn't sure if that was an in-game feeling, or an out-of-game feeling. In fact, he had no idea how long he'd been in the game. Probably not more than 20 or 30 minutes, tops. He inspected the bucket. It looked clean enough, no mold, no blood. He took a sip. It tasted fresh. Hoping that the game's development team wasn't insane enough to model virtual bacteria, he tipped it back and took a few good swigs. Once he'd had his fill, used the rest to start scrubbing himself off, dipping some of the shredded leather into the water as a makeshift washcloth. He proceeded deeper into the maze. The rooms were all made of the same aging stone. What little furniture there was looked like it would collapse if he so much as breathed on it. Funny. One of the rooms had several flat pallets of straw, 5, in total. He'd only killed 2. There might be more of them. He found his way to another hallway. A rat squeaked at his feet. He felt like it had been following him. The creature's chipped buck teeth reminded him of the Raddock's snarling maw. He lined up his spear, then jabbed down, skewering the rat. It was dead instantly. A tiny white wisp merged with Jackson. He'd gained a point of essence. He began killing rats whenever he saw them. He accumulated 8 essence in a few minutes. He didn't see any more rats. He wasn't sure what bothered him more, the fact that he was slaughtering rats for experience points, or the idea that they were actively avoiding him. He was making steady progress through the tunnels, but without any sense of direction, he had no idea if that was a good thing. As he walked, he realized that his health bar was slowly regenerating. It was hard to get a sense for the timing, but every minute or so, it seemed he gained back a few points of health. An open arch with no door caught his eye. He poked his head around the corner. There were 2 individuals inside. A Raddock was seated at a table, reading. Another one was sleeping on a pallet across the room. As Jackson watched, the Raddock turned the page. It didn't look up at him. Jackson slowly lowered his spear against the side of the arch. He drew his iron dagger and crept forward. The Raddock was still focused on its book. He crept closer. Jackson lunged. His knife sank into its neck. Its eyes bulged. He twisted his knife and ripped it out the front of its throat. The creature sagged back dead. Blood dripped down its neck. 0.6 more essence. Jackson crept back for his spear and then made for the sleeping rat. Ike rolled over to face him. Its eyes were closed. A dribble of spit came out of its snout as it snored. Jackson slowly exhaled the momentary panic. When he was close enough that he was sure he wouldn't miss, he jammed the spear into its throat. He planted his foot on its chest, tugged his weapon free, and stabbed again, 2, 3 times, ensuring it was dead. It never even had a chance to open its eyes. 7 essence this time. That gave him a total of 21. You have created a new skill, triple thrust, stab forward 3 times in quick succession. Requires a weapon that can perform thrusting attacks. Essence cost, 15 level, 1 progress, 12.3% neat. Jackson opened the menu and dumped 6 essence into his health, bringing it up to a total of 70. Just from his slow recovery, he was already back at 55 health. He kept the rest of his essence stored up, just in case Hiei's shriek met his ears. A Raddock was at the end of the room. It ran at him, claws raised. Jackson leveled his shield at his foe, prepared to bash it in the face. Wait. How did he do that? No time. He was already committed. Jackson ran forward, putting his shoulder against the wood. If he couldn't use the ability, he'd just do it the old-fashioned way. His shield glowed white. The Raddock slowed and squinted. Jackson pushed the barrier out in front of him. The shield slammed into his enemy. The Raddock was blown off its feet. It tumbled into another Raddock that was coming in just behind it. They collapsed onto the ground. Jackson's essence dropped 10 points. Jackson rushed the struggling rat men, stabbing into them with his spear. They shrieked and squeaked and flopped about. In a moment they were both dead, and he earned back his investment. 15 more essence was his to command. Another Raddock turned the corner. Jackson lunged without thinking. His spear took it right in the heart. The light in the Raddock's eyes faded as its blood spurred down its chest. Jackson stepped over the bodies as more essence flew into his body. Holy shit. This was awesome. He was killing the damn things left and right. His health was still recovering. He'd be up to his new maximum in a few minutes. He heard shrieks in the distance. Squeaks. Some light, some more gruff. He figured that was the Raddock language. Taking them on one at a time wasn't too hard, but dealing with multiple foes could be lethal. He ducked into the first room he saw, closed the door. He almost ran back into the hall. 2 human corpses were opened up on the table before him. They'd been sliced into sections and gutted. Innards were collected in sealed jars on nearby shelves. Various sections of legs and hands packed with salt were hanging from the ceiling. He grimaced, then ducked behind a few barrels in the back of the room. The smell was terrible. Sharp, pungent, like vinegar. Pickled feet were floating in the brine. Jesus Christ. He'd almost felt bad about earlier, sneaking up and murdering that Raddick, but the feeling was quickly evaporating. The heavy squeak speech reached the outside of the butchery. He saw movement through the hole in the door. The dead bodies were shifted and dragged away. There was a heavier grunt. He heard more scampering. The door to his room creaked open. He crouched low behind the barrels, his spear flat on the floor. He kept his shield propped over his head. He heard sniffing. Sniffing? Shit. They probably had a great sense of smell. Footsteps padded closer. The sniffing sound grew louder. Jackson grit his teeth. He felt for the handle of his dagger. He heard an annoyed grunt, sudden motion away from him. The door to the room opened and shut. Jackson gingerly raised his eyes above the level of the barrel. He was alone. That made three times lucky. He picked the room where the smell was so thick that it couldn't tell him from the rotting corpses. He went up and pressed his eye up to the hole in the door. A single Raddick was standing at the intersection, contemplating the spot where the bodies had lain. Jackson shouldered the door open. The wood slammed the Raddick in the back, knocking it over. He gripped his spear and angled it at the creature's neck. The spear tip glowed white. Was it the triple thrust? Jackson didn't move, more concerned with wasting essence than finishing off the rat. The glow subsided. Jackson stabbed his spear into the rat's back, over and over, until it stopped shouting. Hearing more movement from the rooms he'd first come from, he dashed down the hallway. Okay. So, his physical skills responded to his will? That was convenient. He turned a corner and ducked through another archway. A breeze struck his face. Jackson inhaled deeply. It was sweet and humid. Delicious, wonderful fresh air. His passage had opened up into a cavern. Blue moonlight shone down through a great hole in the ceiling, illuminating a pond surrounded by moss. A wooden structure was built around the underground oasis, a series of ramps that climbed up through the hole and out to the surface. Thank fucking God. He was getting really sick and tired of rat mania. Help! Jackson turned. Against one wall was a series of long cages. Three people were locked inside, one of them an old woman, a young girl, and a boy. They were all naked. Dirt and grime matted their hair and skin. They looked like they'd been through hell. The young man threw his body against the side of the cage. Please! Help us! They'll eat us! The girl was huddled in the corner, staring at him. Her brown eyes were as wide as dinner plates. She didn't move. Please! The boy shouted. The old woman crawled to her feet. She grabbed the boy's shoulder and pushed him back. Warrior, I beg you. She said. Please, lend us aid. My soul is old, but theirs are innocent. I beg you. Her hands wrapped around the wooden slats. Do not leave us for the Raddick. Not those things. There was only one question in Jackson's head. Were these real people? Or were they just computer characters? The cold hand of logic settled down back over him. They had to be computer characters, NPCs. Just very realistic NPCs. That was the whole point. Emil Muhammad's words resounded in his head. He could do anything he wanted to do. He could walk up that ramp and make his escape. It wasn't as if anyone would ever hear from them again. When his gaze returned to the cages, the girl was still looked at him. Jackson looked back. He could see a light return to her eyes. She stood up, never breaking their stare. Her fists clenched. He realized he was watching someone who had lost hope find it once again. Could he walk away from that? Warrior! The old woman croaked. Please! Quiet down. They'll hear you. The old woman shut her mouth and clapped her hands over the boy's lips. Jackson walked up to the cage. It was all made out of wood, slapped together with nails. The slats were spaced wide, but not wide enough for a person to slip through. A door on the opposite side is locked with an iron padlock. He didn't have anything to try and pick it with. Get back! The woman pulled the boy back from the side. Jackson stepped back, then turned and shoved his foot at the wood. It creaked, but didn't break. He swayed to catch himself. He tried again, and again. The wood didn't give. Shit, wait, maybe. Game menu. The menu opened up. Jackson selected the pentagram. He had 27 essence. He dumped 12 points into strength. His carry weight jumped 3 points. Close menu. Jackson lined himself up and slammed his foot into the cage. Same result. He slammed it again, and again, grunting with the effort. His leg burned. Sweat beaded on his forehead. The sound of his bare heel smacking the wood thump through the cave. It wasn't any good. He dropped back and put his hands on his knees while he sucked in air. He could hear garbled squeaks, not rats. Raddick. He heard it again. It was louder. They'd heard what he was doing. Shit. Jackson glanced at the ramp leading out of the cave. If he had to choose between living, or dying uselessly in an attempt to save some NPCs, he'd pick living. They're gonna eat us. The boy was crying again. Tears ran down through the dirt on his face. They're gonna eat us, he can't break it. Hush, child. The old woman folded him into her arms, and looked back at Jackson. You did what you could. Go. Jackson found his eyes drawn back to the girl. Her lips were quivering. His hands were still balled up. But now she was staring at the floor. Something in him snapped. Fuck this! Jackson shouted. He roared, dug his back foot in, and kicked again with everything he had. His heel bounced away. He grunted through his teeth and kicked it again, then a third time. He backed up a step, jumped forward, and slammed himself into the wood, foot first. He collapsed into the dirt. Nothing. He was too weak. A few points of essence couldn't make up for a lifetime of sitting in his room, cobbling over motherboards and video cards. He slumped his forehead against the slats of the cage. He gripped them with his hands. I'm not strong enough. Sorry. A shriveled up hand was placed on his. He looked up to see the old woman. It is enough, child. Sing of us to Mother Earth. Our spirits will be with you. Jackson slapped his hand against the slat next to him. It rattled angrily. He couldn't break a damn piece of wood, and now he was going to run away. They'd be diced up and hung to dry like pieces of ham. Wait. That slat had rattled. Jackson stood straight and rapped his knuckles on the slat he'd been kicking. It didn't budge. He tried slapping the other one again. It rattled about in its slot. Child, please. You should not share our fate. Shut up a second. The woman blinked at him, but stepped away from the edge. Jackson sighed. He was always too blunt. It just spurted out. But he needed to think. He glanced at where the slats met with the roof of the cage. The one he was kicking was nailed in shoddy, rusty bolts, but iron all the same. But the other, it was only held in place because it was inserted in a bevel cut into the roof. That's why it was rattling around. The only thing holding it in place was the weight of the top of the cage. He crouched, then grabbed it with both hands. The wood was rough and splintered. He checked his grip, then grunted, lifting with his legs and back. The heavy section of wood above the cage creaked slightly. His lips curled over his teeth as he pulled harder. His hands slipped. A splinter stung his palm, and he fell back onto the ground. A tiny tick of red was missing from his health bar. He set himself again and lifted. All he had to do was get the wood to bend about half an inch, the height of the bevel. The sound of snapping splinters cracked from the roof. He dropped it again. Squeaks were coming down the tunnel he'd come from. He couldn't tell how close the cave made them all echo. He set himself again. Another pair of hands joined his on the wood. The girl was crouched opposite him. Jackson caught her eyes, then nodded. She sucked in her breath, then grunted. He squeezed his legs and pushed from his heels. There was another snap. Jackson flew back as the wood popped free of its slot. The long slat clattered to the cave floor next to him. The girl slipped through the bars. She grabbed the boy and pulled him through. The old woman was next, but she was slow to move, hobbling. Jackson spotted a nasty red gash on the back of her ankle. It looked bad, definitely infected. No time for that. He waved them forward. Come on. Jackson went for the ramp, scanning the cave for any sign of Radic. It sounded like they were about to pour in from every direction, but none had reached them yet. The girl supported the woman under one arm as they stumbled after him. A louder shriek came from above. A Radic was racing down the ramp from outside. Jackson ran upward, holding his shield high. At the last moment, he crouched, bracing his body against the shield. The momentum worked to his advantage. The Radic slammed into him, but it flipped up over and rolled down the ramp. Jackson popped out of his crouch and stabbed it to death before it could get up. He glanced over at his new baggage. They were watching him, wide-eyed.
The hell are you doing? Move it!
I thank you, the woman said.
Thank you? Go!
The girl steered the woman up the ramp. They hobbled along at an excruciatingly slow pace. The boy darted ahead of them, peeking up over the edge of the cave.
I think that was the only one. Let's go!
He ran forward and scurried out of sight. At the top of the ramp, the girl stopped.
What about you?
Jackson was watching the tunnels. When he turned to face her, he inhaled sharply. Her back was covered in puffy, bloody marks. She'd been whipped.
I'll figure it out, Jackson said. Keep going.
She shook her head.
You did not abandon us. I will not leave you to your death. If you don't hurry it up, you're going to be rat food. Then rat food I shall be, she said louder.
Chaki, the woman said. Listen to him, and take me onward.
But Shaka, he's dash, now.
Thank you, the girl said. A moment later they were over the ridge of the cave. Jackson slowly backed up the wooden walkway. The first Radic to reach the room shrieked and spluttered and waved its hands, but it didn't attack him. Another one came, and then another, until five of them were slavering at the bottom of the ramp. The walk could fit two people side by side, but with his shield and spear poised in front of him, Jackson posed an intimidating choke point. With those injuries, the girl and woman were going to need some time to get any safe distance away. He had to hold them off. His health was just about at maximum. He could do this. He heard a sound like a high-pitched growl. It was deeper than the usual squeaks. The group of Radic immediately scampered away from the ramp. A monster emerged from the dark. It was half again as big as the next biggest Radic, easily taller than Jackson. While the others wore bits of tattered cloth, this one was smart enough to make use of sturdy leather. It held a spiked wooden club. It growled under its teeth up at Jackson. He held his ground. The Radic looked over its shoulder and snapped its fingers. It pointed at him and growled something. Two rats as big as dogs leapt up the wooden ramp. Jackson stabbed at one. His spear pierced into its open mouth, killing it, but also lodging his weapon in the beast's throat. The second one dashed under his reach and bit into his ankle. He let go of his spear and drew his dagger. He plunged his weapon into the rat, stabbing through its hide again and again. It remained stubbornly latched onto his leg. His health bar dropped alarmingly fast. He stabbed it again, right in the eye, and pried it off with his fingers. The corpse rolled off the ramp and into the pool of water. When Jackson looked up, A club was in his face. It felt like being hit with a pillow that held a brick in its center. He flew back. His head smacked the wooden ramp. Ringing filled his ears. The Radic hefted the club for a crushing blow. Jackson rolled left as it came down, letting his shield fall from his hand in order to dodge the hit. The club smashed through part of the ramp. Jackson got to his feet and scrambled back. He still had the height advantage, but only half his health. Another hit from that club might be lethal. His spear was still lodged in the corpse of the rat. The Radic kicked his fallen shield down into the cavern. Jackson drew his iron dagger. The Radic made a coughing grunt. Jackson realized it was laughing. The situation was comical. In a way, Jackson, armed with what amounted to a tiny knife, stood facing a monster almost twice his size, wielding a club that could probably crack boulders. Jackson found himself grinning. This was exciting. He was on the ropes, sure. But Jackson had been dealt shitty hands before. The fear, the panic, that was all gone. He was playing a game, and he intended to win. The Radic leader was tough, sure. He'd seen worse in plenty of video games. Instead of a controller, he was using his hands. He needed a surprise. Jackson leaned back. He raised his hands, holding his dagger up. He took a long breath, then bellowed the biggest war cry he could manage. His scream tore into the cave, echoing off the walls. The smaller Radic, watching down near the pool, covered their ears. The leader hesitated. "You have created a new skill, war cry." Jackson pushed off the ramp and leapt, throwing himself bodily at his enemy. His arms and legs wrapped the stunned creature. Jackson jabbed his knife into its back, pulled it out, stabbed again, dragged and twisted it through leather and skin. The creature made a pained roar. The Radic grabbed Jackson's shoulder. Needle claws pierced around his collarbone. Jackson kicked and scraped and stabbed, but the Radic was still stronger than him. It peeled him off and tossed him down the ramp with a growl. It reached behind its neck and groped for the dagger still protruding from its back. It pulled it free and tossed it down into the pool. The distraction gave Jackson enough time to pull his spear out of the rat corpse. He held it in both hands, the tip pointed at the Radic's snout. The leader regarded him warily now. They stared one another down, weapons ready. Jackson flicked his spear forward to test for a reaction. The Radic immediately stepped back. It narrowed its eyes, and slowly took the space once again. It brought the club up and lunged. Jackson was ready. The tip of his spear glowed white. He thought the words in his head, triple thrust. His spear shot forward. He was still moving his hands, still doing the pushing, but a higher power was guiding him, as if the point of the weapon was riding on invisible rails. It stabbed into the Radic's stomach. As fast as Jackson thought he was capable, the force made his pull his spear out, and he stabbed the exact same spot, this time puncturing all the way through the leather armor and driving into the creature's abdomen. He drew back again. The club was coming down diagonally, aiming to crush Jackson's neck. The third thrust seemed to know about that even before Jackson did. His spear leapt up to the Radic's exposed upper arm and jammed itself into the bicep. The club stroke fell short as the Radic growled and retreated from the pain. Jackson stabbed again, going for its face. It smacked his attack aside, but kept retreating. It clutched at its stomach wound with its free hand. Jackson noticed that blood from the slice on its arm was running down over its club hand. He swept the spear like a bat, aiming for that spot. The side of the iron point smashed into its wrist. "You have created a new skill, pull arm swing." The Radic dropped the club, hissing. It growled and snapped at Jackson with its jaws. That was an empty gesture trying to get him to hesitate. Jackson had the momentum. Jackson held the shaft of his spear steady and charged down the ramp. His mouth was open. He was roaring something. His heart pounded in his ears. The only thing running through his mind was that he had to kill this thing, and kill it dead. "You have created a new skill," charged Jackson, gashed it across the snout, but it managed to twist its head out of the way of a straight-on blow. It grabbed the spear below the tip and pulled it from Jackson's hands. Jackson saw it coming. He let go of his spear as the creature tugged, and it took a step back, off balance. He tossed himself at the creature again, and he drew his second dagger, the one he'd picked up from the first Radic he killed. It was made of bone, sharpened to a wicked point. He jabbed right for the Radic's eyes. He struck home, and the bone sank into the hilt. Jackson's momentum carried him onward, and he rolled down part of the ramp, slapping hard into the wood before coming to a stop. The Radic stumbled about, trying to collect itself. Open wounds in its back, a hole in its stomach, a ripped up arm, and being half blinded with too much. It tumbled into open air and planted face first into the rocky shore of the pool. The ugly sound of bone snapping hit Jackson's ears. He heard a sharp plinking sound, like a bell dropping onto the floor. A white orb, bigger than the others he'd seen so far, drifted out of the monster and into his chest. The gathered Radic looked down at the corpse of their fallen leader. They looked up at Jackson. Jackson looked back, and then he let out a war cry. His shout had been effective, but this was different. There was a scream inside of his scream, a primal, projected fear that echoed along with the sound. It blasted at the ears of the Radic. They shrieked and ran off into the caverns. Jackson stood there for a moment, arms raised over his head, his hands shaped into fists, and basked in his triumph. He went to gather his gear together: spear, shield, and two daggers. He tried the club, but it was incredibly heavy. Not strong enough yet. The giant Radic had shriveled up. A sort of black ooze surrounded the corpse, seeping steadily into the water. Nestled in the rocks near the pool was a sparkling crystal. Jackson stooped and picked it up. The crystal looked like a shard of black obsidian. A tiny white fire burned in its center. He turned it in his fingers. The edges of the gemstone glimmered in the moonlight, but the white flame stayed the same. He gripped the stone tightly, then went up the ramp and climbed out the roof of the cavern. The cave opening was surrounded by a thick, leafy forest. The full moon lit everything with a pale light. The night air was warm. A breeze washed over his skin. The fresh air felt good. A small wooden watchtower was at the top of the ramp. He climbed the ladder to get a better view. The forest was more of a large stand of trees, rather than a true wood. He could see a section of wall sticking out from the ground part of the ruins that wasn't buried. He was standing on some sort of sunken city. A stream emerged from one end of the woods. He could see a lake in the distance. The woman and the girl were either upstream, or downstream. Deciding that down was the easiest path for an old crone with a torn up ankle, he started in the direction of the water's flow, toward the lake. He stopped for a brief drink, then kept on through the trees. He stayed alert. Where there were rat people, there were sure to be plenty of other fun things. The exhaustion was starting to hit him. He'd been through a lot in the past. Hour? 2 hours? It might be a game, but his aching muscles were telling him it was real. He leaned against a tree and took a quick break from walking. He had 34 essence, now. Pretty good. Game menu. Polearm swing. Whip the tip of a polearm in an extended swing. This maximizes reach and strength, but the force of this attack can break weaker shafts. Essence cost, 15 level, 1 progress, 12.3% charge, a full body rush. Risky, but can overwhelm an unprepared enemy or turn the tide of battle. Essence cost, 20 level, 2 progress, 26.7% war cry, push essence into a mighty battle cry. Rally your allies, strike fear into your enemies. Essence cost, 25 level, 1 progress, 20.4%. Jackson winced when he saw how expensive war cry was. He could have a whopping 59 essence. But coming off of the fight, he hadn't been paying that much attention, and getting the Radic to flee was definitely a good thing. It was worth the cost this time. His abilities weren't all just hard numbers. The Radic had seen him brutally maim their leader. That had a definite effect by itself. The war cry was just the trigger to get them to run. Maybe he just needed to get used to the system, but the programming of the monsters was so good he couldn't discern any patterns. That was the thing about video game enemies. Because they were programmed, they all had patterns. Some were very complex or obscure, but it could all be reduced to variables, to hard math. Given situation X, the computer-controlled baddies would react with Y. That fight had shown him that any such patterns in Isis would take him a long time to unravel, if he could figure them out at all. In most role-playing games, enemies would swarm and mindlessly attack as soon as they spotted the player. In that fight, the Radic had thrown cannon fodder at him first, and realizing that a crowd would be at a disadvantage on the thin ramp, had taken him on one-on-one. More than that, there was endless variation to the attacks. It didn't use the same motions again and again. It was thinking, actively looking for weak points. It kicked his shield away so he couldn't use it. It tried to scare him into backing off when it was injured. It might as well have been totally real. And those NPCs. Goddamn. Now that the moment had passed, he didn't feel as, well. He didn't have a word for it. But it was like saving real people. They responded to what he said, to what he did. The girl had actually helped him when he came up with a strategy for the cage. That meant a programmer had predicted that a player would use that kind of strategy, and had programmed the ability of the girl to help. Hell, it meant the programmer had allowed for that strategy to work in the first place. It was a freakish level of clairvoyance. Emil Muhammad was a fucking genius. Isis was going to change the way video games were made forever. He glanced at his passive skills. He was building quite a list. He had sprinting, daggers, shields, spears, and now grappling, kicking, and sneaking. They all had their own modifiers. He still wasn't sure how his passives affected him, or how his statistics actually modified his passives. Jackson rolled the black crystal in his hands. Another mystery. He opened up his statistics panel. 15 strength, 16 vitality. 0 agility, compulsion, persuasion, and spirit. He considered for a moment, then threw another 5 points into strength and 4 into vitality, bringing them both to 20. That left him with 25 essence, enough for a war cry, if he needed it. Jackson's OCD was well satisfied by the move. His health was at 75, a nice milestone from 50. And his carry weight had topped out at 40. Apparently his spear, shield, daggers, and leggings amounted to 15.4 of weight. It wasn't marked by any units. Finished taking stock, Jackson closed the menu. He looked down at the scar on his left hand. The twisted black star was merged with his skin. The only thing he knew was that the mark was supposedly bad, making him a threat to humans and angels. As a result, he'd been banished to the bottom of the mighty tower called Babel. Jackson recognized that name. It was from a biblical tale. Mankind, in arrogance, tried to build a tower to the heavens, the Tower of Babel. God struck down their attempt, and smote the tongues of the offenders so that they all spoke different languages and couldn't continue to work together. This was the divine explanation for lingual differences. He felt at his scar with his other hand. The warped black pentagram looked ugly, but the texture was just like normal skin, as if it was a badly drawn tattoo. According to the men that banished him, he'd carved it into his own flesh while sleeping. It was more than a little creepy. When he lifted his fingers from the pentagram, a transparent prompt appeared in front of him. Do you wish to travel to the ninth circle?
No,
Jackson said.
I do not want to travel to the ninth circle. I do not want to do that.
Definitely no. The prompt vanished. His scar pulsed white. Jackson flinched. The light died. The forest was quiet. Nothing happened. He steadily exhaled. All right, what the fuck was going on? Humans alone were supposed to have built the Tower of Babel. Angels had nothing to do with it. The base of the tower was apparently an old fucking ruin in the middle of nowhere infested with rat people. He didn't see a tower anywhere, and he didn't know where the fuck the giant tree was supposed to fit into all this. And now, his scar was a direct connection to the lowest tier of hell. No fucking wonder they banished him. He was marked by the devil.
Fuck!
Jackson grunted. He pushed himself up off the tree. Too many questions whizzing around in his head, and not nearly enough answers. He felt like he was treading water, barely keeping his head above the waves. He'd killed some rats, but he still had no idea what he was supposed to do. What had Emil told him? Be himself. Do what he wanted to do. As much as Jackson worshipped the ground that Emil walked on, he hated the phrase be yourself. Okay, sure, he hadn't changed his appearance. But what the hell good was that advice when you were still trying to figure out what you were? Did adults all suffer from some sort of chronic memory loss that patched out what high school had been like? Do what he wanted to do. Those were less offensive words, but still uncomfortably vague. He could start walking, but he had no points of reference, no sense of the land. Usually, in video games, there was a very clearly defined goal. In a racing game, you raced. In a first-person shooter, you shot other people. Even in a role-playing game, you played a role. You were generally the hero. You saved the damsel in distress and kicked ass. Story points were relatively obvious. Go to the beleaguered king, accept his quest to find the sacred doohickey of power, and save the world. That sort of thing. Even in totally open sandbox-style games, they usually directed you toward a story-related mission, or pointed out a few spots of interest. And those would naturally lead to other spots, other missions, and you'd start planning your game around them. Sure, you could do whatever you wanted, but after being told that a pot of gold was just over that hill to the north, most people started climbing the hill. Pointless sticking around in virtual space could only entertain for so long. Eventually, everyone ended up playing the game that the developers had made. This was different. It was an entire world, ticking along with or without him, and the developers could care less about what he did, or when he did it. Jackson held the mighty power of self-determination, and as a result, he felt like a dog that had finally caught its own tail. His only quest hook was transporting himself to the Ninth Circle, which sounded suspiciously like a one-way trip to the Lake of Fire. So, what the hell was he supposed to do, exactly? He looked down at his pants. Getting a change of clothes would probably be a good start. There were still those NPCs. The old woman, the girl, the little boy. Maybe the old woman could lend him a hand. She seemed to know what was up, or something. Probably. Jackson sighed and kept on downriver. Chalky stepped out of the water. Her back felt swollen and hot after leaving the coolness of the lake. Her long brown hair was plastered to the back of her neck. She shivered. On your stomach, girl. Shaka, we need something to cover ourselves with. The forest will tend to our clothing, shortly. The woman said. She coughed. Now lay down. Chalky picked a grassy spot and obediently lay on her stomach. Her little bother, Pala, danced out of the water behind her. Chalky, it's just me and Shaka. Who cares? We got away from the Radic, that's more important. For the moment. For keeps. Her brother said. The warrior will fight them off. Her brother planted his hands on his hips and stared into the forest, as if the warrior would emerge from the trees at any moment. Chalky did not feel so certain. The pale-skinned young man had stayed and struggled to free them even when Shaka had urged him to flee. Even when he might have made a clean escape. And then they had abandoned him. They had done to him what he refused to do to them. She felt like a slug. The slime under a slug. We have no honor. Chalky spoke quietly, so that Pala could not hear. If I spent all my father's honor on this, I would still be in debt. It can wait. Now hush. Shaka's leathery hand settled on Chalky's back. Chalky winced, even at the slight pressure. The uncomfortable warmth of inflammation was starting to rise as her adrenaline faded. Shaka drew lines with her fingers across Chalky's back. She used her essence, her spirit, as she did so. Where her fingers touched, a soft white light trailed behind, as if she were painting upon the skin. When the runes were completed, the symbols flashed once, and then sank into Chalky's flesh. The heat of the whip marks was whisked away. Welts were soothed and sank down. Long tears and Chalky's skin swam together, leaving behind only pink marks and a few scabs. Shaka sat back and exhaled. Her face had paled. Ha! You should not strain yourself too much, but you will be fine. Your ankle? I have already treated it. I will need a longer rest, but the healing has begun. I am sorry, Shaka. Chalky said. For speaking back to me in the cave. Yes. I understand. You did not want to abandon the warrior. As usual, Shaka had read her mind as if it were sitting in the dirt in front of them. Chalky sat up and nodded. Your heart was in the right place, even if your pride was fat. Shaka said. But when a man know. When a person declares their fate, you respect that choice. Now help me up. We must keep moving, and my leg cannot bear all my weight yet. Chalky pulled Shaka from the ground, letting her teacher drape an arm about her neck. Pala, we're going. Come. What about the man? We can't go without him. Pala. Shaka said. He is a powerful warrior. He'll catch up soon. For now, we must ensure we do not make ourselves a burden once more and gain distance from the Radic nest. Shaka had a way of weaving words that made Chalky envious. The thought of further indebting himself to the warrior made Pala leap ahead of them along the lakeshore. Chalky began to walk with Shaka, at a faster pace, now, almost a full stride. Shaka was sweating and panting with the effort. Chaki looked at her, concerned.
Just an old heart, Shaka said. Let us continue.
After a half hour, they were on the opposite side of the lake. Shaka informed them that she could no longer feel the presence of Radic souls. They sat down to rest. Shaka was pale, and still sweating.
Do you need water?
Chaki asked. Shaka waved at her again.
Ha. Yes. A little water will set me straight.
I taught you the runes to weave wood, yes?
I remember them.
Get us some modesty. And a bull. Keep an eye out for Swellreed. Are you sure that your ankle dash? I will not repeat myself. We can't afford to waste time.
Chaki bit her tongue and waded into the brush of the forest. The leaves and branches scraped at her skin, but it was not a dense wood.
Chaki huffed a bit to herself.
Shaka said that her pride was fat. The way Shaka had sat hit her ankle under her back. She had not used too little essence on herself, and too much on Chaki. It was worrying. She found the swell reed and picked a small bushel of stalks. Near sources of water, the reed often outgrew the plains grasses. They were mashed with an equal part of water, and could be spread on the skin to relieve the heat and pain of swelling. Shaka had taught her to look for it by the white fuzz that lingered in the rivulets of the leaves. Chaki went up to a tree. She had little essence for lack of sleep and food, but it was enough for her task. She drew white lines in the trunk with her finger. Tree talking was a difficult process, and she rarely had chance to practice out on the plains. Plants tended to grasp ideas quickly, but they latched onto them too hard and were very stubborn if you tried to convince them into something else. The bark parted as a bowl grew from the tree. The wood of the plant flowed like thick clay, changing as she had asked. Chaki tried to make it round, but it came out oblong and rather misshapen. The tree had its own aesthetics. Shaka would scold her for being soft, but who was Chaki to demand a perfect bowl? The tree proved more amenable to the idea of clothing. Big leaves poofed out in green chains that could be tied around the neck and waist. Chaki looped them over one of her wrists as she grew them. Her thoughts turned back to the warrior. His skin was frightfully white, as if he were some sort of ghost. She had never seen skin like that, not even amongst the Iron Men. Perhaps he had been a spirit, the vengeful wrath of those taken by the Radic.
Geez, I didn't think you'd get so far.
Chaki whirled, clutching at her bundle of wood, reed, and leaf. The pale ghost was before her, his spear in hand, his shield on his back.
You're alive?
Yeah. I guess. He looked her up and down. He cleared his throat and averted his gaze. Chaki remembered that she was naked. She felt her face grow hotter than her wounds had been. She ducked behind the tree.
Forgive my immodesty.
It's fine. Given the situation, I think you have an excuse. Chaki slipped her legs through one wrapping of leaves, then draped another around her neck. With her body somewhat covered, she leaned back around the tree.
I am decent.
He looked up. His eyes trailed over her. Her blush did not subside.
Where's the other two?
Toward the lake. Chaki stepped out from behind the tree.
Thank you for saving us.
Thank you?
I owe you a tremendous debt.
Can you show me how you did that magic trick?
Chaki frowned.
Tree talking?
I cannot teach you.
Shaka is our spirit guide, and she takes only one student. It is forbidden for me to pass the knowledge to others.
I'm sorry.
Well, maybe I can convince her.
Payment for lives.
Maybe. Chaki said. Shaka took her role very seriously. She would not be easily convinced. Chaki was torn between telling him that outright, and not wanting to upset him, so she said nothing more on the matter.
My name is Chaki. Again, I thank you for saving us.
I'm Jackson Vidalt.
A long name.
Chaki considered something.
How do you know our language?
Are you from some distant tribe?
Outsiders I have encountered had their own tongue. I didn't realize I was speaking another language.
I'm just talking in English.
I don't know what English is, but you are speaking clearly to me.
Jackson frowned sharply for a moment. His eyes narrowed.
Huh. All right.
So, want to lead me to the lake?
It's this way.
Chaki gestured and moved forward.
He had not really answered her question, but she decided not to press it. As they walked through the wood, she watched him sidelong. She expected him to take a tad more advantage of her somewhat shoddy modesty, but he kept his gaze to himself. She found herself oddly disappointed. Did he not find her attractive? His eyes were a sharp, calculating green. They were surrounded by dark circles. His hair was a mess, floating above a whitewashed forehead. She felt intensely curious about him.
So then, you are a stranger to these lands?
Yeah.
You could say that. Spirits!
She snatched his left hand, examining the twisted black scarring.
Does this hurt? I have to heal you immediately.
Jackson tugged his hand away.
It's an old scar. Just looks bad. It's fine. Are you sure?
I'm sure, he said. He cleared his throat, and they started walking again.
What about you? Where are you from?
Our tribe should still be nearby, I hope.
Chaki answered. It was a good twist of fate. We were sold to a place closer to home than where they took us for the selling.
She looked at him.
I am of the people of the plain under the mountain. We travel the flatlands, following the bison. We take from their lives for ours. The boy you saved was my little brother Pala. I am student to Shaka, my tribe's spirit guide. She leads us in matters of essence, where the elders cannot.
So, like a medicine woman.
Chaki tilted her head. She does know much about medicine. But more importantly, she is our living connection to the Mother Earth, our link to the world spiritual.
She retains knowledge of the past, our ancestors, and the sacred runes, which use essence to bend the spirits in the land and living things to her whim.
Awesome, Jackson said. It is worthy of all.
Chaki agreed.
Wait, Jackson said. If you can do all that, why didn't you escape from the cage yourselves?
The wood was dead, Chaki said. It could not listen to our runes.
Oh, Jackson's face grew pensive.
So you're Shaka's student then? The next spirit guide? Chaki puffed up her chest a bit. She selected me for my natural talent with essence. It is to me that she shall pass all her knowledge, and when she returns her spirit to Mother Earth, I shall become Shaka in her place.
Jackson's attention was firmly on her then. Chaki realized that the way she was moving, her chest out, made the leaves ride up quite high on her body. She felt a sudden nervousness and hunched over the other way. There was an awkward quiet for a moment. Jackson broke the silence.
So is Shaka a title?
Title? Chaki was unsure of that word.
The spirit guide is named Shaka. When the role changes hands, the new guide becomes Shaka.
Weird.
It isn't weird, Chaki said. It just is.
I mean.
Jackson shook his head.
Never mind. I'm not good with people.
Talking, I mean.
That is fine. I do not like people who speak frivolously.
She smiled brightly at him. Actions speak far louder than words, Jackson Vidalt. You have already shouted to me what kind of person you are.
I'm glad you think so, Jackson said. And there was a small smile on his face, too, a half lift of his lips.
Chaki felt a little thrill in her heart.
You.
His lips searched for his words. You would have really stayed there and fought with me.
I would have, Chaki said emphatically. I am as good a fighter as anyone in my tribe.
Though injured as I was. Jackson's face changed. It turned into a deep frown.
I was worried when I saw your back. But it looks better now.
Chaki was torn between gratitude over his concern and panic that her back was completely exposed to his gaze. Her modesty was being torn into tiny shreds. He'd think her some sort of slattern. She angled herself away from him, trying to get as much leaf between his eyes and her body as possible.
Shaka healed it, as she could.
You better watch where you're going. The words had barely left his mouth when Chaki's foot caught a root. She tried to catch herself, swayed arms out, flapping in circles. Jackson caught her under her arm. He brought her back straight.
Jeez. You all right?
He was close. Too close. His bare skin was pressing against hers. She tried to fight her blush.
No use.
He was staring right at her.
I'm fine.
I'm fine. Jackson laughed and stepped away from her.
You're kinda cute when you're flustered.
Chaki could say nothing past the lump in her throat.
Hey, are we getting close to the lake yet?
She took a breath to steady herself.
We're nearly there.
Chaki, is that you?
Chaki!
Pala came crashing through the bushes. His eyes widened.
It's the warrior!
Jackson's voice had a flat amusement.
It's Pala.
Pala gasped and clasped his hands over his mouth.
How did you know my name?
Chaki rolled her eyes.
I told him, you hollow tent pole.
Oh.
Thank you, great warrior!
Pala placed his hands together and bowed in a child's mimicry of respect. Jackson rubbed his neck a moment. He shrugged in a strange acceptance of Pala's thanks.
You're welcome. Is Shaka all right?
Chaki asked.
That's why I ran when I heard you.
Pala said.
She's sweating more, and her face is really hot. I think she has a really bad fever.
A dead son. Chaki swore.
I knew it.
Pala covered his mouth again.
You can't say bad words.
He hissed through his fingers.
Be quiet now, Pala.
Chaki stalked toward the lake. When she cleared the trees, she saw that it was as bad as Pala had said.
Worse.
Shaka was on her side, groaning.
Shaka! What's dash?
Chaki saw the ankle as Shaka rolled the other way. It was even more swollen than it had been. A pus was oozing from the wound, around which the skin had blackened. Red lines trailed away from the source of the infection.
Shaka!
Chaki! Chaki fell next to her teacher and grasped her hand.
What is this? Didn't you treat your ankle?
You're whipping, it was infected.
I did not have the energy to spare. How long did you hide this from me? You wasted your energy on me.
I made a decision.
I can heal this. Shaka, I can still heal this.
No.
I can.
Chaki shouted.
We have to cut it off, but we need a fire. We need to boil water, boil bandages. I will use what you taught me.
Chaki. Shaka's hand cupped her face.
Do not cry for me.
Chaki felt the water on her cheeks. She slapped Shaka's hand away.
I am not crying. I know how to heal this.
Ha. Shaka groaned and grit her teeth. You will return to the tribe and live happily.
Cutting my foot off may save me, but out here, I would only die from the blood loss.
You do not have dash. Shaka sucked in a breath.
You do not have enough essence to do everything.
No.
I do. You are weakened by our captivity. I will not see you kill yourself with runes that take from you more than you can give. I have enough essence.
No, you do not. Shaka shouted. Her face tightened. She breathed for a moment.
Take Pala and go.
Chaki stared at the thin old woman before her. She had never once considered Shaka feeble. All her life, Shaka had been strong. She was Chaki's invincible teacher, wise in the ways of the world, at peace with the spirits of the earth. Even with wrinkled skin and a clouded right eye, she could outshoot Chaki with her bow and arrows,
Shaka couldn't die. She was a pillar of Chaki's world. She was the soul of their tribe. When father had died, she had pieced Chaki's heart back together.
I, Chaki said, have had enough of abandoning people.
By the spirits, girl, Shaka said. See reason? The only reason I'll see is the one that ends with you on your feet and outrunning me.
Warrior, Shaka said. I see you there. What is your name?
Jackson Vidalt.
Thank you, Jackson Vidalt. May I ask of you a favor?
Sure.
Take Chaki and leave. She cannot do what needs to be done.
It needn't be done, Chaki shouted.
Hey, Jackson said.
He kneeled next to Chaki and reached into his tattered hide leggings.
It's a long shot, but do you think this would help?
Chaki's eyes might have burst from her head. Resting in his hands was an essence crystal. She could see the fire, feel the burning power locked inside the black stone.
Mother Earth!
She prostrated herself before Jackson, clasping her hands together.
Please, allow me use of your stone, please!
She looked up at him from where she was bent down across the ground. She could see the calculating look in his eyes, the same look he had when he asked her to learn runes. He had already given them so much for nothing in return. He felt no need to give them more. Could she blame him? She had no right to demand yet more salvation. But she needed it. She needed Shaka to live.
Please, warrior. If you have any heart at all, Jackson Vidalt. Grant me the use of the stone. It will let you cast powerful magic.
Chaki nodded. Essence, take in solid form. Crystallized.
I have no right to ask more from you, but please. She is as a mother to me. I wish I knew how you felt.
Jackson held out the crystal.
If it will save her life, take it.
Chaki reverently lifted the stone from his palm. Cupping it in one hand, she began to trace lines across Shaka's ankle. They were crude words, simple, forceful. There was no prodding, here, no conversation, no bartering with this disease. Chaki held a fire strong enough to burn away such considerations. She clenched the stone, tight. It shattered in her grip. White light glowed from her skin. She channeled it down into the runes. They rose up and raged against the infection. A ring of white light shone down Shaka's leg, leaving it unblemished and normal as it passed. The magic died. Chaki slumped, spent from the effort. She laid her head on Shaka's breast, and she cried. Shaka shifted. Normal color had rushed back to her face. She looked at Jackson.
That is four lives we owe you, Jackson Vidalt. And two of them are my own.
Jackson nodded.
Would you teach me runes?
Shaka rumbled a sigh under her breath. Her wrinkled face settled down low over her eyes.
Hmm.
She said nothing else. Jackson watched them for a moment, then glanced at Chaki.
Do me a favor?
Chaki looked up at him with her big brown eyes and freckled nose.
If is within my power, Jackson Vidalt, you may have any favor you wish.
Jackson considered several naughty answers to that invitation, then fell back on his original thought.
Watch over me for a moment.
What do you mean?
Game menu.
The transparent screen showing his picture and options appeared in the air in front of him.
Hey, can you see this?
See what?
What are you talking about?
So, the game menu was invisible to them. And he automatically spoke and understood their language.
Cool.
He tapped the logout button. The box warning him about the vulnerability period appeared again. Jackson tapped through it. The screen went black. He waited in blackness, sensationless. For a moment, he almost thought something was wrong, and then he entered white space once again. Isis had made him wait the full 30 seconds before putting him back at the main screen of the dream. He exited virtual space altogether. He felt his mattress under his back, the helmet on his head. The thin pistons that held the drive in place retracted. He slipped the machine off and ran for the bathroom. He flipped the seat up, fumbled his fly open, and a moment later, he sighed in contentment. When you had to go, you had to go. He was halfway to zipping himself up when he stopped. The black scar was on his left hand. The twisted marks sat there, burned into his skin. Jackson touched it, rubbing at it. He blinked, and it was gone. Jackson gave his head a shake. He moved to the mirror. Same Jackson. Same messed up hair. Still himself. Just an afterimage or something like seeing spots. He took a deep breath. He smelled something. He frowned. The bathroom was clean, compared to the rest of the house. He'd reluctantly given in there. He could avoid the kitchen and the living room, but the apartment only had one bathroom. Jackson lifted his shirt. There were splatters of dry, black blood on his skin. Jackson reached down with his hand. His finger felt at the crusty red patch. He scraped it off with his nail and rubbed it between his fingers. It flaked away. He lifted his fingers to his nose and sniffed. It reeked of Radic. That wasn't possible. That was virtual blood created in a virtual space from him killing a virtual enemy. There was no way it was real. Shit.
Oh shit.
He was hallucinating. He was now a proud member of the 1 in 10 million club that was screwed by the dream drive. Something in his brain had been poked the wrong way. He ran his hands through his hair. He gripped the counter.
All right.
Keep it together. Think. Think about how to prove yourself sane. He dashed out of the bathroom. Still in his socks, his feet slid across the hardwood.
Mom, Mom!
She was still strewn over the couch. Her eyes were focused on the television screen.
Don't yap at me, this is the good part. Look, I just need you to dash.
She raised a hand at him, grabbing for the remote so she could turn the sound up.
Shut up, Jackie!
Some moron character in the sitcom made a statement of the obvious. The wife of the moron made a face and gave a one-liner response. A laugh track rolled in the background. His mother coughed a smoker's hacking chuckle. Jackson lifted his shirt and pointed at the black droplets of blood.
Can you see this? I just need to know if you can see this.
Jesus.
What?
That black stuff? Is it marker? Jackson dropped his shirt. He ran back into his room. He slammed the door shut and threw the bolt.
Holy fuck!
He pinched his leg hard. Okay, that hurt. Not a dream. Was this real? Was ISIS actually real? What the shit?
Okay.
Calm down. Get analytical. How do we test this? Jackson's eyes scanned his room. He spotted the little camera perched on his computer monitor. He brought up the program and angled it to record his bed. Then, he laid down, pulled on his drive, and entered ISIS once again. When he woke up, he was lying next to the lake. Chalky was crouched near the water, hands around her knees. She leapt up.
Jackson Vidalt? How did you do that? What happened? What did you see?
What?
What did you see just now?
Chalky shrunk away.
You asked me to watch over you. And then, you just collapsed?
I didn't know what to do.
And then, a little later, you vanished entirely. Your body just melted away. And then, you reappeared, just now.
Holy fucking shit.
Holy shit. This is real. This is fucking real.
Jackson bit his lip. Okay, his camera was recording. He'd check it later to confirm, but it seemed as though he was being physically transported into ISIS. The implications spun in his head. He was shirtless again, back in his leggings. The only thing that traveled with him was himself, flesh and blood, and the smears that were directly on his skin. Did this mean he could use what he learned in the real world? Could he take magic back home?
Magic.
Magic used runes. Was the pentagram on his data chip a rune? Was the scar on his arm part of that spell? And what did it all mean about Emil Muhammad, about Crux, the game company? He thought back to what Emil said in his message. He realized it was all hinting at this fact. Emil had said he wanted to create a world better than the old one, and he had. He'd actually done it. He'd somehow combined magic and technology. And now Jackson was some sort of modified existence with a health bar and special abilities. Had Emil discovered real magic back on Earth? He must have kept it a secret for some reason. Why use it for this, for ISIS? What was he planning? And if the world was real, were angels real? Was the Tower of Babel real? What did that mean? A hand grabbed his left arm. Jackson pulled away automatically. It was Shaka. She was hale and back on her feet.
What was that for?
You are marked, Shaka said. She crooked a finger at his wrist.
Great Mother Earth.
I did not notice it before, but there it is. Jackson turned on her.
If you've got answers, I'd love to hear some, because I don't know all that much about it myself.
Not here, Shaka said.
Not now. We must return to the tribe.
What for?
I will give you the answers you seek, Jackson Vidalt, as well as I can. And I will teach you a rune or two, perhaps.
I will repay the debt I owe you. I ask only for your patience. Jackson hesitated. He felt like he could sense the betrayal on the horizon.
All we have to do is return to the tribe, Jackson. I swear we won't all gang up on you once we're there.
But he had saved her life. She seemed intent on making up for that. And if there was one thing he needed, it was knowledge. That was worth the risk.
All right, Jackson said. I'll go with you.
And later, I'll put in a call with Crux's customer service department. Chalky glanced between them rapidly as they spoke.
I don't understand. What is going on?
Jackson Vidalt, what is the meaning of your scar?
It's complicated, Jackson said.
He looked down at himself. He was reminded of the blood still coating his skin.
I'm just going to wash this off. Is your tribe close?
Close enough, Shaka said.
How close is that?
No more than 10 miles or so.
How are we getting there?
On foot, Shaka said.
How else?
We have no horses. Jackson didn't think he'd walk 10 miles together in his entire life. He sighed, considered his options once again, then shrugged and walked straight into the lake. He rubbed the blood off his chest, washed away the grime, the scent of the rats. He felt his thoughts settle. Being clean always helped. He sucked in a big breath and floated on his back. He'd let his panic get a foothold there, for a moment. Right now, his only realistic move was to go along with Shaka. Even if it turned out to be a waste of time, the runes alone made the trip worth it. Magic was a big deal when you didn't have any at all. All right. Go with Shaka. Get his info. Learn a rune or two. If it was a trap, and they had to destroy the devil-marked human, well, he'd cross that bridge when he got there. That was still only a footnote in front of the larger realization that ISIS was a real place. This water, it was real. Shaka, Pala, Chalky, they were all real people. The Radic were real. What would happen if he died here? Jackson finished his float in peace. After organizing his thoughts somewhat, he climbed out of the water. He scooped his hair out of his eyes. He realized Chalky was watching him. When she saw him watch her back, she turned her head away and blushed. She didn't look like much back in the cage, but now, he was definitely feeling a little jungle fever. She had a slim, tall body, not petite, but compact, almost muscular. Small breasts raised a little crest of leaves around her neck. Her skin was a rich mocha brown. Freckles dotted her shoulders and nose. Her hair was darker shade of brown, almost black. She was cute as hell. He wondered if he had a chance. He wasn't exactly impressive, as himself, but her blushing teased at his fantasies. He wasn't sure if she was just thinking about earlier, stumbling across her in the woods, or if she actually had a little thing for him, well, he could try and flirt with her. He'd probably fuck it up. Shaka led the way through the forest. Pala fell in behind her. He seemed distant. Maybe he was just tired. He couldn't be older than 12, at most. The situation was starting to catch up with him. Chaki looked at him. Her eyes were still slightly red from when she'd cried.
Jackson Vidalt, about earlier. I was emotional.
You were.
It was unbecoming of me. I can offer you nothing in return but what these hands can give you. I hope, in them, you will find some recompense. You've already given me something.
I have. Chaki asked.
Yeah. Jackson said.
You have.
What?
He walked past her.
Doesn't matter. Chaki lingered behind him for a moment, then moved to catch up. She didn't ask him what he meant. He was glad for that. He didn't really know how to put it into words. The wood thinned, then opened onto a plain. It was huge. Jackson lived in Boston. He'd never been to the Great Plains. He imagined this is what they had to look like. It was totally flat from one side of the horizon all the way to the other. Short prairie grass, just a few inches high, matted the ground in an unbroken yellow-green carpet. The sky, though, that was what was amazing. The sky covered them like an impossibly huge black dome. The moon stood in its center, obscuring most of the stars, but the prairie was so well lit it might as well have been daytime. Jackson leaned back.
Whoa.
Jackson Vidalt? Chaki asked.
What is it?
There's more hills where I live, Jackson said. And less sky.
Where are you from?
Don't bother him with your questions, Chaki.
Shaka said.
It is as he said.
Complicated. A stubborn look crept on Chalky's face.
Well, I feel I ought to know certain basic details about the man that saved my life.
If that's all right with you, Jackson Vidalt.
Jackson shrugged.
I'll tell you what you want to know. I just don't know if you'll get it.
There, you see, Shaka?
He does not mind. She nodded perfunctorily.
I am confident I will understand your explanation.
Shaka sighed. She began to walk onto the plains, and they followed.
I do not know why I bother. She talks back to me, she ignores my orders. She bothers our guest, ignoring all politeness.
I know what it is. She grows more proudful and stubborn because she knows the men are looking at her, and she thinks she isn't a little girl. Apparently the great and revered Chaki must no longer take direction from her elders.
I didn't say all that. Perhaps I shall take a more obedient student.
Oh, Chaki got in trouble. Pala said.
Be silent, Pala. Chaki said.
He is right.
Shaka said.
You are in trouble. And here I thought I was your second mother.
Shaka, do not make light of that.
I meant what I said. Shaka placed a hand on her forehead.
Oh, woe to me, that my sometime daughter rejects my words.
Chaki and Shaka started going back and forward. Jackson snorted a bit at some of it. It was easy to tell they had a strong relationship. After a time, Shaka stopped her teasing and wrapped Chaki in a one-armed hug as they kept walking.
Honored warrior?
Pala asked. Jackson looked down at the boy. He had Chalky's dark eyes and smooth brown hair, though he kept his shorter. He was about three-quarters Jackson's height.
What's up? Thank you for saving me, and my sister, he said.
And Shaka, too.
It's fine. I will repay my family's debt, he said.
He thumped a hand to his chest.
On our honor.
Heh.
All right then. Don't let me down.
And then they walked. Chaki and Shaka kept talking, and eventually one of them said something the other didn't like, and they started their bickering. Pala smirked up at Jackson.
Are they always like this?
Jackson whispered. Pala shrugged.
They are practically the same person. My mother says that there is room enough for only one type of person in each tribe, so they always butt heads. But you saw Chaki. They love each other. I can't tell whether you're insightful, or just parroting your mother.
Pala laughed.
Probably the second. I'm not proud like Chaki. She only started arguing openly with Shaka in recent months.
Any particular reason? Ever since Bunta asked to be the father of her children.
What? Bunta is a warrior hunter in our tribe.
Pala said.
He's a good man. He is always kind to me. Chaki wouldn't have him for some dumb girl reason or another. Anyway, Chaki was the first of her friends to be asked for mating partnership, and I think her head grew several sizes.
Well, Jackson said.
If she hadn't disobeyed, Shaka would be dead right now. But she's still not to disobey her. Shaka is our spirit guide.
You do what the spirit guide tells you. But I guess you're right too, Ish.
Pala scratched his head.
I don't like politics. I think I am just going to stay a hunter warrior, like my father did.
Pala snapped his fingers.
Oh, you're an outsider, so you don't know how things are, really. Maybe I can help.
Aha. Someone he could pry for information.
That'd be great, Pala.
Jackson said.
Tell me about your tribe. Well, we number about 400 by ourselves, and our band is half of a larger tribe of the plain under the mountain. The tribe has two elders, one from our band, and one from theirs. Shaka is our band's spirit guide. We follow the herds of bison that cross the plains, and hunt them for food, and bone, and hide. We meet with the other band regularly to trade and exchange news, and then we meet together with the other tribes once a year. Sometimes more often, though. There are other tribes that do not move across the plains. We trade bison meat and hides in exchange for their fruits and vegetables and other supplies.
Jackson wondered where these people had come from. Humans left behind while building the tower, he imagined.
They'd reverted to a more traditional lifestyle.
I see. What was that part about fathering children?
Well, Bunta wanted Chaki to be the mother for his children.
Pala said.
He would have made a good brother, but Chaki said no. Jackson decided that the sophistication of Pala in matters of marriage was likely not all that high. He decided to change the subject.
How did you end up in those cages?
We were headed back for the mountain meet.
Pala said.
That's when all the branches of the tribe gather under the great mountain once each year. It is always at the end of summer, when food is plentiful, so that there can be many people together. And all the elders talk, and decide on things.
Like what?
Like, where each part of the tribe is to hunt, and they things out if elders have arguments, and what to do when the tribes need to work together. Things like that.
Pala didn't have much of a future in politics, but at least he was smart enough to realize it.
Okay. So, getting back to the cages.
Yeah.
At the last meet, well, we were in argument with another tribe. It was decided that we would have to fight to settle our dispute. Very early this year, we made war against each other, and they won. They pushed us south to these lands for our hunting. Dangerous lands, too many trees. The wood is useful, but they shelter things like radics, and the land of the Iron Men is too close.
Iron Men?
Iron Men. Pala said. They wear clothes of iron for protection. Shaka says they have strong magics that let them force spirits to their will. They don't have much interest in us, but they have made many farms on our borders lately. One of the elders thinks we ought to make war and drive them away.
I think so too. That was how we ended up caged.
So, what happened?
There was a raid, while most were sleeping.
Pala said. His feet crunched through the grass. They stole horses and kidnapped some of us. I'm not sure how many. They took us to their town, and sold us as slaves. We passed to another man, who bought us, and then sold us again to those things.
Radic.
If the Iron Men are friends with Radic, then we are no friends of the Iron Men. Jackson tried to put it together. A more advanced civilization was slowly advancing on these plains tribesmen, and they weren't very nice. He looked over and saw Chaki and Shaka watching him and Pala.
Jackson Vidalt.
Pala said. When we make war with the Iron Men, will you help us? You're a strong warrior. Jackson wasn't sure if he wanted to commit to an extended campaign.
He shrugged.
We'll see.
Ugh.
You sound as my mother. I want to teach those men a lesson. They hurt my sister. Jackson glanced back at Chaki. She looked at him a moment, then away. He could still see the somewhat healed welts on her back. He patted Pala's shoulder.
Thanks, Pala.
I'm gonna talk with Chaki and Shaka. Pala seemed to light up at the idea that he'd been helpful.
You are welcome.
He skipped ahead of them on the grass, then leaned down, investigating some bug or ant. Jackson ambled for the other two members of his party. They walked side by side for a moment.
I will keep an eye on Pala.
Shaka announced suddenly. She picked up her pace and moved ahead of them, leaving Jackson and Chaki alone. They said nothing for a time. Jackson looked at the moon. He blinked when he realized it wasn't the same. Still white and glowing, but with a different pattern of gray and black craters.
No man on the moon.
My brother is enamored with you.
Chaki said.
A little, maybe.
I can tell.
She said. Perhaps I have said this too many times, Jackson Vidalt, and my words feel dilute, but thank you for what you have done.
You're welcome.
And it's fine if you just call me Jackson. Why would I call you only part of your name?
Jackson thought for a second.
Where I'm from, longer names are more common, so amongst friends, people tend to shorten them.
Oh.
She smiled. Then I accept your invitation to be more familiar, and shall call you Jackson. I don't know if my name can be shortened, though.
Yeah, what would it be?
Chuck? Jackson shook his head. It's missing that cute part at the end.
Chaki is better.
You think my name is cute?
Chaki asked.
I think you're cute. Jackson said. Chaki blushed and wrapped herself in her hands.
Score, Jackson thought.
Please, Jackson, spare my modesty.
Hmm?
Jackson grinned.
That's hard to do.
You're really pretty. I will not be so easily flattered.
Jackson shrugged.
I don't think I'm the only guy who thinks so, right?
What about Bunta?
Chaki sneered. I heard Pala mention him to you. His compliments are rat poison.
Sorry.
Didn't realize it was a touchy subject.
It is fine.
She looked at him. My brother finds him admirable, and he is capable, when he can be bothered to quit his napping. At the last meet, he distinguished himself in the games. But he struts about our camp as if he is an elder himself. I care little for him. And he is against the war.
The war?
Chaki nodded. My brother told you some of that. The plain under the mountain has long considered war making against the Iron Men. Now that they have become the aggressors and that they seem to have a connection to the Radic, it is likely that the mountain meet will decide to form a war party. Bunta is on the other side of the issue. He does not want to challenge the Iron Men, but rather, move further north, away from their lands. He says the plain is vast, and their armor is strong, so why should we bother to throw ourselves against them for nothing? By this time, Chalky's lips had curled up again. It is just like him. He is a coward. You have strong opinions on the subject.
I do.
Chaki agreed. And look what came of our inaction. We might have all been killed. Bunta will not live this down. Shaka had not committed one way or another, but I think these events will change her mind. When the meet comes, our tribe will be a voice for war. They'd been walking for a long time. Jackson was surprised that he wasn't feeling tired. He just kept plodding along.
The wood was shrinking in the distance, a tiny patch along the emptiness of the horizon. Maybe his increased vitality had something to do with it.
So then? Chalky said. Where are you from?
It's gonna be hard to explain. Jackson said. But I'm from another world entirely.
Another Earth.
He gestured under his feet. Not another country, or another land. An entire other world.
Is that where you returned when you vanished?
Yes.
I see.
Chalky shrugged. That does not seem beyond explanation to me. I didn't think you'd just accept it like that.
Why should I not?
I saw it happen. Spirits are not confined to this land alone.
Jackson decided that he really starting to like Chalky.
Well, my world's a hell of a lot different.
Anyway, to be honest with you, I'm not sure what's going on with my scar or this world.
But you traveled here, did you not? You must have some idea.
Yeah. But in my world, this was supposed to be a game.
A game?
That's right.
Jackson said.
Let me see. We have a way of controlling dreams, using very strong magic. That lets us play inside our own dreams.
When you have control of your own dream, you can do anything you'd like.
Chalky's eyes widened.
Spirits.
I can imagine. That must be incredible magic.
If you have that, why did you come here? Why do you want to learn Shaka's runes?
I thought this would be another dream game.
Jackson said.
But as it turns out, it's real.
I've been transported to another real place. Our magic relies on special materials that are only found in my world, so, if I want magic here, I need to learn Shaka's runes.
So you thought you were just playing another game?
Chalky said.
But now, who would want to transport you here in reality?
What's the point?
That's a good question.
Jackson said.
I have no idea.
Mysterious.
You are quite mysterious, Jackson.
Do you know what an angel is?
An angel?
Yes.
Chalky nodded.
Angels are the greatest spirits of the Earth Mother. They are her servants, and oppose negative spirits, black souls, which are collections of everything that is bad in the world.
Demons.
Jackson's brain worked on overdrive trying to reconcile the combination of tribal spiritualism and Christian mythology.
All right.
So how did your people get here?
Do you have stories that tell you this?
Indeed.
Chalky said.
Ours were a people under the angels. The angels sought to build a great tower to honor the Earth Mother. When they finished the tower, they left, and took the most blessed humans with them. We are descended from those left behind.
Chalky brushed her hair back.
It is our shame, but also our purpose. One day, the angels may return. We strive to better ourselves, that we might be regarded as worthy of ascending ourselves.
Where's this tower that they built?
Chalky shrugged. I do not know. That is a matter for elders and spirit guides. It would not do to have people desecrating the works of men and angels.
Jackson frowned.
I have a little information. Apparently I was a slave for the angels myself, helping to build the tower.
Well, that was supposed to be the story anyway.
But the angels aren't building the tower to honor the Earth Mother.
Then what are they building it for?
Well, in the original legend, they were trying to reach heaven, the afterlife.
Jackson said.
Why would angels need a tower to return there?
Chalky asked.
Another good question.
Jackson said.
Normal people I can understand, but I figured an angel could just, I dunno, fly home?
Chalky chuckled.
Maybe. But I have another question.
Go ahead.
The tower was built generations ago. How is it that you're here now, in the future?
Jackson shook his head.
No, I didn't move through time, I don't think. I was banished because of this.
Jackson raised his scarred left hand.
This is a mark of darkness. Apparently it makes me a danger to angels. They told me they were banishing me to the bottom of the tower, and they threw me into this magic pit. I woke up in those ruins surrounded by Radix. I was fighting my way out of there when I found you guys.
Jackson gestured around himself.
But where's the base of the tower then?
I mean, the thing is supposed to be huge.
Even if it has been a long time, it should be more than a mess of sunken hallways.
Strange.
Chalky said.
Very strange.
Chalky stuck her tongue out as she thought.
Jackson watched her.
He tried not to think about the way her breasts jostled under her leaf clothing as she walked.
I know.
She said.
You can travel through worlds, yes?
I guess so.
So, perhaps this is the base of the tower.
Chalky spread her arms.
The land itself.
And if there are multiple levels of the tower, then that would make each world a different level.
A grand tower indeed.
That. Jackson couldn't confirm her theory, but it wasn't bad at all.
I think you're really onto something.
That was impressive.
It only seems logical.
Jackson grinned.
Smart, and pretty.
I'm not sure what part one liked more.
Chalky blushed again.
She did that a lot.
He kinda liked it.
Enough nonsense.
She said.
So you're saying you're dumb?
Humph.
She slapped his arm.
Hardly.
I have had many men compliment my beauty, but few have said much about my mind.
Your brains are more voluminous than the stars.
Jackson said.
Your logical deductions are like prairie flowers blossoming in the summer night.
Your questions are dash stop it.
Chalky said.
She was giggling.
Now you're just being ridiculous.
Hey, seriously.
I like smart girls.
She grinned at him.
A warrior like you.
Such men seem only concerned with the width of a woman's hips.
I'm not a warrior back home.
What are you in your world then?
Jackson had no answer to that question.
He was a gamer, sure, but she wouldn't really get that.
and he didn't want to come off as superficial. He'd said that their technology was akin to magic. He found himself with a sudden awareness of his role.
I'm a magician. I know how to put together the special materials in our world to perform magic. So that's why you were so curious about the runes.
Chalky said. She made a smirk.
Is there a smart woman in your life then? Back home?
No. Jackson said. There isn't.
Oh. I'd assumed, what?
Nothing. Chalky said quickly.
Earlier, Jackson, when you said to watch over you, before you vanished.
What about it?
Please don't do that again.
She said.
I was very worried that something had happened.
Sorry.
I didn't know what would happen myself.
He shrugged.
I thought you might freak out when you heard the truth. I should have known though. You're tougher than you look.
How so?
You didn't give up. Jackson said.
With the cage.
Well, I thought that if I could make a difference, then I should.
You're pretty awesome, Chalky.
Heh. She folded her arms and smiled. I hope I have earned your trust then, Jackson.
Definitely. She took in a breath. A soft hand was placed on his shoulder. She looked him in the eyes.
I'm glad.
Jackson felt a heat rise to his face.
Yeah.
He mumbled lamely. She let her hand rest on his arm a moment, then drew back as they walked forward.
So, is your world very different from the plains?
Extremely. Jackson said.
Do you know what a building is?
A building?
Yes.
I saw them when we were being sold at a market. She gestured a square. Big stone structures, so that many people can live together in one spot.
I can't imagine it. It must be terribly boring to sit in place like that.
Take that. Jackson said. And multiply it by 10,000.
Multiply what?
Everything. Jackson said. The number of buildings. Their size. The number of people. Everything.
Imagine a massive town of houses that never ends, so many crowded together you can't even see the sky.
That's what my home looks like. I'm not sure if I like that idea.
Me neither.
Jackson took a long breath, tasting the fresh plains air on his tongue. I think this is better. People aren't supposed to be squashed in like that, living like ants. It changes you. Makes you paranoid. It's impossible to get to know them all. There's so many people that everyone's a stranger.
That's awful.
Yeah. It is. There can't be enough bison for so many people.
There aren't.
Jackson said. Only the magics we've developed over the years are able to sustain that kind of population density. You play an important role, then, being a magician yourself. Supporting all those people. Jackson stared at his feet as he walked. He could just let that impression stick. He didn't have to correct her. Yes, back home, he was a great magician, helping to keep society turning, a man of strange and powerful magics.
No, he said.
No?
I don't understand.
I'll be honest with you, Chalky, he said. Comparatively speaking, I was smaller than a speck of dust sitting on a single blade of grass in this prairie.
Oh. I'm good with our type of magic, he said. And I live comfortably enough.
But that doesn't matter. There's so many people, so much happening, that unless you are at the very, very top, you just fade out into the background. If I died, no one would care. My own mother wouldn't care.
Jackson, forgive my judgment, Chalky said.
But your world does not sound very pleasant.
It wasn't, Jackson said.
It isn't. Maybe our meeting was fated.
Fated? Jackson asked.
Chalky nodded. She watched the horizon. Perhaps you were meant to come here all along.
It's a nice thought, I guess. She smiled at him.
Well, if it was fated, or if it was simply a happy accident, I'm glad you came when you did. And I am glad to call you Jack.
Jack, huh?
I thought I would shorten it again. She said. So that we would be even closer.
If that's acceptable. Jackson smiled. He wasn't an expressive person. His smile was just the slightest turn of his lips, the crease of his skin at his eyes. But it was a big smile, for him.
It's very acceptable, Chalky.
Good, because I had no intent of calling you otherwise.
Sounds like more proud talk if you asked me.
Ugh, Chalky said.
Do not quote Shaka at me.
Or what?
Chalky slapped his arm again. Or I shall stiffly reprimand you, Jack.
Oh gee, that stings.
Whatever shall I do, now that Chalky has reprimanded me?
Chalky's foot swept out and hooked under his. He sprawled down onto the grass. His spear rolled away. Chalky put her hands on her hips and laughed.
Oh, how the great warrior has fallen.
Jackson sat up and grunted.
He rubbed a hand on his ankle.
Chalky, that really hurt.
I think I twisted it.
Chalky's eyes widened.
I'm sorry, Jackson. That wasn't my intention.
Is it bad?
Jackson reached up with a hand.
Maybe I can walk it off.
Help me up?
Chalky nodded and reached down. Jackson grabbed her wrist and pulled her down on top of him. She shrieked and started batting at his chest.
Liar, you liar, Jack.
Revenge time.
She had a lot of bare skin.
He started tickling her, brushing up along her abdomen. She started kicking, half laughing.
Stop! Stop it!
Make me. Jackson reached up under her arms and scratched. She went wild, squirming and laughing and slapping back at him. His health bar actually took the tiniest hint of damage when she scraped him. He had a clear advantage, but after he'd had his fill, he let her grab his wrists. She sat up on top of him, pinning his arms to either side, leaning over his chest.
Looks like I win. I've defeated the brave warrior. I surrender.
Jackson said. He was getting an amazing view of the underside of her breasts. The small orb stood up proudly under the leaves. The long, naked legs hooked around his abdomen weren't bad, either.
So, what are you going to do with me?
Chalky grinned evilly, raising her hands, but when Jackson didn't react, she stopped frowning.
What?
Heh. Nothing. She followed his eyes. He saw her face change as it hit her. She jumped off of him as if stung.
I forgive me, I was lost in the moment.
Jackson climbed back to his feet.
Did you hear me complaining?
But my modesty. Chalky narrowed her eyes.
Were you toying with me?
Maybe.
Jack. I like the idea of a beautiful woman climbing over me.
So sue me. Chalky's face turned through several shades of white and red, as if she couldn't decide whether to be amused, frustrated, or embarrassed.
Sue you? What does that mean?
There was a long, wailing groan that rumbled from under the ground. Jackson felt like it sounded like a combination of a whale's cry and a rock slide.
You too,
Chaka called.
Get away from there, now.
Who minds? A voice like crunched gravel rolled over Jackson.
Who man's walking on me? Get off. Get off.
Jackson and Chaki took off running. They jogged up and stopped near Chaka and Pala. When he saw the looks on their faces, he turned and glanced back. A massive arm was lifting itself out of the ground. Clumps of dirt and grass rained back to earth as a two-story tall man climbed out of a hole it had been laying in. Only it wasn't a man, it was made of solid rock. A moving statue.
I leave you alone for a few moments,
Chaka said.
And you wake a golem. Spirits save us. Who man's woke me up?
The golem rumbled.
Played on my stomach, ruined my knob.
Shouldn't we say something? Jackson whispered.
He doesn't seem too violent.
Yet.
Say what, exactly?
Chaki hissed.
I don't speak rock. Weren't you listening? He just said he was annoyed with humans playing on him while he was napping.
The gift of tongues, Chaka said.
Jackson, speak on our behalf. If I were you, I'd start by begging for forgiveness.
Suddenly it hit him. He could understand and speak to his new friends, though they didn't know English. He'd never even thought about that, it just happened. And now, he could understand this golem. It must sound like a bunch of chewed up rocks to them. Jackson stepped forward.
I'm sorry, great golem. We didn't realize you were there.
Aha? The golem crouched down and peered at Jackson.
A who man knows how to speak to the earth? But no matter. He walked upon me like a common paved road. I'm sorry.
Jackson repeated.
We didn't see you.
Didn't see me? The golem stood back to its full height.
Do you think me a fool? Jackson, you're just making it angry.
Chalky shouted. Jackson ignored her.
You were covered in grass, he said. Look at yourself.
The golem paused and looked down. True to Jackson's word, most of its front was still layered over in prairie grass. It looked back where it had laid, a deep, man-shaped impression in the ground.
I never would have stepped on you if I could see you.
Jackson continued.
But you blended right into the plains. You have our deepest apologies. We did not mean to disturb you.
Hmm. The golem rumbled.
I see. I nap for too long, and who mans walk here now? I will move then. Who mans are much too noisy.
The golem turned. Its feet thumped away over the plains, mashing muddy holes in the grass as it went. Jackson sighed.
That was amazing,
Pala said.
Jackson Vidalt, you are amazing.
Truly. Chaka said.
Come. We should keep moving.
Jackson caught back up with Chaka. For an old woman, she sure could move.
You know about me. More than I do myself. Like I said, Jackson Vidalt.
Chaka repeated.
We will speak further when we reach the camp. I've got one burning question.
One then. Chaka said.
If I can understand you, and the golem.
Jackson said.
Why couldn't I understand the Radic?
Chaka glanced at him, then back to the prairie.
Many things in this world do not wish to be understood, Jackson Vidalt. Be careful what you try to speak with.
Then they walked. And walked. And walked. The sun began to rise in the east. The moon was still in the sky, but it faded as the air turned pink, then blue. Jackson found himself absorbed by it all. He'd never seen it quite like that, a fat, yellow-orange orb coming straight up over the horizon. He needed to get out more. He turned from the sun. To the north, in the direction they were headed, was a small black spike. He pointed at it.
What's that?
The mountain, Chaka said.
Right. The plains under the mountain.
Jackson shrugged.
Huh. I just thought it would be bigger. It is big.
Chaka chuckled an old woman's laugh.
We are just very far away. Perhaps 150 miles. If the day were not so clear, we might not see it at all.
Jackson held idle conversation with Chaki and Pala. He learned a bit more about the tribe itself, how they lived, how they worked. He told them stories about home. It was interesting explaining it to someone who had no concept of it at all. Chaki found public school to be a particularly fascinating idea. He told her about how good performance in classes was an important bar to judge matriculation into yet higher institutions of learning, and then performance in those places supposedly set you up for a productive role in society. In the end, though, a lot of it came down to who you knew, rather than what you knew. When he told her he hated the process altogether, she said she wouldn't like to be harvested for her intelligence, either. It was an interesting way of looking at it. Children were grown and raised like crops, en masse, at the lowest cost possible. Just when Jackson was starting to feel truly thirsty,
they stumbled across a section of prairie pockmarked by shallow puddles. Apparently, these pools were called wallow spots where the bison had rolled on the ground, creating low spaces deep enough to collect rain. Jackson was worried about drinking water that had been sitting in the open like that, but a quick rune from Shaka solved the problem. 2 hours later, they'd reached the bank of a wide creek that ran through the plains. It was difficult to see from a distance a tiny, shallow canyon running through the grass. They started along the water's edge. He wondered how Shaka kept her bearings. Was it magic? Or did she just know the land that well? Their idle conversation eventually turned to silence. They plodded along, all anxious to get where they were going. Jackson felt exposed, out here, in the silence. The heat of the day steadily increased as the sun grew higher, and their shadows turned to dots beneath their feet. And then they began to bend back the other way. If he'd worn a shirt, he'd have taken it off. Walking was an easy task, but the endlessly repetitive motion was grinding an ache into his joints, extra vitality or not. He started leaning on his spear as he trudged along.
Doing okay, Jack?
Chalky asked. Jackson made a grunt.
Lot of walking. That wasn't so far. Not used to it.
Chalky grinned.
Yes.
And too used to your easy life.
Would you like some help? That eager to get your hands on me? Perhaps I shall watch you suffer a bit longer.
Jackson grunted again.
Some way to treat your savior.
Chalky playfully turned up her nose.
More like a single-minded boy who is not thinking about proper things. Don't think I miss your wandering eyes. You didn't tell me to stop them from wandering, though.
That is true. She said neutrally. Jackson looked at her then, and let his eyes wander. She cocked an eyebrow at him, then faced the way they were walking. She stayed quiet. He enjoyed flirting. It made him feel masculine. Powerful. She was a wild animal, and their dance of words was a way to rear her in, bring her to his side, tame her. It was a little roller coaster of emotion. There was the thrill of gaining ground, the victory of winning another smile from her face. But then, the slight chill when he thought he might have pressed too far, the half-panic when she seemed offended. And most of all, the heady sensation that he wasn't entirely in control, that the reins were slipping in and out of his grasp, that he was a horse that she was trying to tame, a twisting duel of hormones and double-entendres. In real life, he'd never have gotten this far. He wouldn't have tried. He wouldn't have bothered. He'd be too nervous to start, too fixated on everything that could go wrong. What was it that had changed? It was Isis. Yes, it was real. Or, he was pretty sure it was real. But his mind still thought of it like a game. His heart felt that it was a game. And in many ways, it was. He could get stabbed in the gut and keep on living. He could strengthen his body with the souls of fallen enemies. He could talk to golems. Jackson was a loner. He was an introvert, but he wished he was better with people. Everyone else always seemed to know the right thing to say, as if life was a movie and they were speaking from the script. He was the B-list actor who hadn't bothered to memorize his lines. But games were different. Jackson loved games because they were safe. They were closed systems. He could pick them apart, study them, analyze them until he knew every nuance and crook and cranny, until he could set record times and high scores with one arm tied behind his back. With time, any game could be dominated utterly. Life was different. It was open, unpredictable. He didn't handle it, couldn't handle it. Trying to understand it was like trying to hold a wet bar of soap. And when you bend over to pick it up, life screwed you in the ass.In games, time didn't matter. Games could be paused, saved, reloaded, attempted again and again. Ironically, knowing he had all the time in the world let him make decisions faster, easier, and with greater success. In real life, with the clock of reality hanging over him, he was paralyzed by the potential consequences of his actions. Isis made him feel different. Maybe it was the abilities, the game menu. Maybe it was the fact that he just brutally murdered a cave of rat people. Maybe it was the sheer unreality of it all, the fear that he might wake up and it would all be a dream, that it might not matter, that it had never happened in the first place. That it all came down to one single conclusion. It was the one he usually felt his way toward. Somewhere, in his heart of hearts, Jackson thought of Isis as a game, and in a game, he didn't have to give a fuck, that made him invincible. The most powerful force in the world was apathy. When he didn't care about the consequences, nothing could stop him. He didn't have to hold back, because if he failed, well, what did it matter? What are you thinking about? Chalky asked him. Jackson raised his head. He'd been staring at the grass as he hiked along the edge of the creek, lost in thought. He looked at her. She seemed part of the landscape, a child of a prairie. Her skin, her eyes, her hair, all shades of brown set against the green grass. Clouds like gold ingots streaked the sky behind her, cast in place by the late afternoon Sunday.
I find you attractive, Chalky, Jackson said. I just don't want you to think I'm shallow. I know we haven't really known each other that long. You are a very honest person, Jack, not shallow. I am glad for that. I do not mind at all that you find me attractive. I find you attractive as well.
She gave as well as she got, he'd give her that. Jackson cleared his throat, but no more words came to mind. He wasn't sure where to take the conversation.
When I asked you for the essence crystal, Chalky said, you told me that you wished you knew how I felt. What did you mean?
Jackson frowned over the change of subject for a moment. The memory came back to him. He nodded.
You told me that Shaka was like a mother to you. I don't really know the feeling, to be honest. Has your mother moved on? No, she's alive. We don't have a good relationship.
I see.
What of your father?
He's dead.
Mine too,
Chalky said.
Pala was telling me about him. He died just 3 years past. Chalky said. It was hard at first, but we have embraced his spirit in our hearts.
Good.
What happened between you and your mother?
Chalky paused.
I'm sorry. Perhaps that was too forward.
It's fine.
I'm just glad you didn't say I'm sorry.
Heh.
Chalky said. We have that in common. I hate the false pity directed toward the grieving. But don't blame them too quickly. What else is there to say?
Not much.
Jackson admitted. But I'd rather they say nothing at all than spout a few words about how sorry they are that some guy died 7 years ago. You didn't like your father either?
I loved my father very much.
We both did.
Then, your mother?
She changed after he died.
Slowly.
She buried it in drugs.
Alcohol.
She started smoking again. She stopped caring about me, so I stopped caring about her. My mother had Shaka to help her back up.
As did I.
Chalky's eyes were distant. Perhaps if Shaka was not there, I might have had a more similar tale to tell.
Maybe.
I won't bother you about it again.
Thank you for sharing that.
It's not bad to talk about it.
Jackson said.
We're more similar than I realized.
I think so too.
I'm glad, if this makes us closer.
Why's that?
Jackson asked.
Planning on mothering my children?
You had to ruin a nice moment.
I didn't hear a no.
Chalky's face held a devil smirk.
Maybe I am still deciding.
Let me just cut you off short then.
He said.
I'm not really crazy about children.
Then I shall bear at least 4 of your children, if only to spite you.
Jackson choked on his own spit. Pala's shout caught them.
Smoke!
He was several yards ahead, waving back at them.
I can see smoke.
And then Chalky was running. She ran, and then ran faster, until her feet beat the grass and the wind whipped her hair behind her head. She left Jack and Shaka and Pala behind. The teepees rushed into view. A darkness hovering over Hart finally lifted. Jackson had pried it free, but now it floated away. She was home. She was free. She and her brother were free. The men and women of the tribe shouted and pointed as she ran by. She heard others call out to Shaka. She ran through the nest of tents. It was a mess of campfires, men and women carrying water, cleaning new and old hides, sharpening tools, or just talking to one another. Chaotic to any outsider, but perfectly organized in her head. She found her teepee. Her father's feathered war shirt hung from the outside. Her mother had hung it there when he died, and there it had remained, no matter how many times their teepee was disassembled and reassembled. While the elder disliked the display, Shaka had approved of it, and that settled the matter. She stared up at his coat. Each feather marked one of his exploits in battle, some painted red on the occasions that he had been injured. He used to sit with her and tell her stories of war-making. His favorite story was painted on the jacket itself. It showed him riding a horse. He had dismounted his enemy, then gotten close enough to tap his shoulder with his spear, leaving him alive, all followed by making his escape through a storm of arrows. He had died 3 years ago. But he died well. The entrance to the teepee was brushed aside. Chalky's mother, Landy, stood there, tall, silent. Her eyes welled up.
My daughter.
She paced forward and wrapped Chalky in her arms.
Chalky. Oh, Chalky. Are you a spirit come to haunt me?
Chalky hugged her back.
I'm still in this place, mother. I'm home.
And Pala and Shaka too?
Oh.
Landy gripped Chalky tighter.
I am so glad that my heart could burst. All to comfort me was your father's spirit, but he did better than that. He delivered you back to me. He sent us a strong warrior.
Chalky said.
You will see him, soon.
Chalky! Chalky and Landry separated. Bunta was running through the teepees, followed by more than a few others.
Chalky!
He stopped in front of her. His head was shaved close, and his body was muscular, giving him a strong, forward appearance. His face was flat, but his chin jutted out wide beneath it.
Thank the spirits. You are whole. What of the others?
Chalky placed her distaste of Bunta aside. He was still the elder son, and now was not the time for private matters.
Shaka and Pala are returned as well.
As to the others, I do not know their fates. Everyone murmured audible relief when they heard that Shaka was safe. A band without a spirit guide was a band all but lost. She suspected that they were preparing to fold themselves into the other half of the tribe altogether, come the meet. Shaka's salvation was the preservation of their individuality.
You said that your father sent you a warrior.
Landry said.
Who did you mean?
She meant Jackson Vidalt. Shaka's voice called. The crowd parted as the old woman ambled forward.
I need a horse. I am too old to walk on feet so long.
She moved amongst the people, clasping their wrists and allowing them to welcome her back. Chalky grinned as Jackson Vidal picked his way behind her. Shaka might complain, but Jack was in much worse shape. The way he winced as he moved amused her. He was so strong in some ways, but obeyed in others.
Who is this outsider?
Bunta asked. He examined Jack's spear and shield.
This is the warrior you mentioned. I cannot believe it.
Believe it, Shaka said.
For he is as much a person under the mountain as you, Bunta. Though his name is much too long.
She snatched Jack's chin in her hand and turned his face from side to side.
You will need a new name, Jackson Vidalt, if you are to become one of us.
Something shorter, I think. Jack mumbled something else, but Chalky couldn't hear it.
Nonsense,
Shaka said.
Stand proudly, Jackson Vidalt. You shall make a proud member of our tribe.
There were more voices in the crowd. People parted to allow someone through. It was the elder, and Bunta's father, Yucatan. He had a flat face with small features, like his son, though his skin held more wrinkles. A tall headdress sat on his head, lined with white feathers and dangling with beads. He brushed his hair from his eyes.
Shaka! Thank the Mother Earth and praise each of her stars. And Chaki, and little Pala.
I'm not little! Pala protested. Everyone laughed. Chaki laughed with him. She had a good feeling then. A feeling that things were somewhat back to normal. Landry smiled, but she gripped her son's shoulder.
Pala! Do not speak back to the elder.
Yucatan smiled at Landry. Your son's tongue flaps often, but perhaps we needed his words.
Shaka, did any others return?
Shaka shook her head.
Three others were eaten by the disgusting rats. Of Hanna and Shale, they were sold to other buyers, as slaves.
Then the Iron Men have a connection to the Radic.
So it would seem.
This set off a chain of whispers and turned heads. Chaki nodded. This was as it should be. It was certain that they would make war, and the Iron Men be damned for bringing the wrath of the people under the mountain upon them. Their vengeance would be righteous.
I heard something over the gathering.
Yucatan said.
That an outsider would be made part of the tribe.
Yucatan gestured at Jack.
This man, I presume?
Indeed. Shaka said.
I have weighed his spirit, and it is heavy. His is a brave soul.
No matter the spirit. Bunta said.
An outsider? Part of the tribe?
Such is unheard of.
There are traditions you do not know about, boy.
Shaka said. Bunta frowned. Chaki smirked inwardly. Shaka had twice rebuked Bunta calling him boy, and deserving the use of his name.
My grandmother's time saw such an act. A merchant of the Iron Men once visited us frequently to trade. In time, he came to love a tribewoman and lived amongst us fully, and was made a member of the tribe. I believe Jackson Vidalt worthy.
Hmm. Yucatan eyed Jackson. Jack was busy examining his feet.
This bravery you speak of seems focused on the ground. Can you not look an elder in the eye?
Jackson glanced up. His eyes were sharp again. Chaki could see the gears turning in his mind as he stared at the elder. There was tension in the air. Everyone seemed to be waiting for him to say something. He looked at her. Chaki shrugged and made a face behind Yucatan's back. Jack made his small smile.
Elder,
Jackson said. He was very slow with his words, careful, plodding.
I do not wish to disturb your tribe. If it bothers you, then that's fine.
Nonsense, Shaka said.
You are already in the tribe in spirit. You shall shortly be in name. Is that not so, Yucatan?
Hmm.
Father,
Bunta said.
An outsider?
Boy, Shaka warned.
No, Shaka, Yucatan said. I will hear my son.
Shaka folded her arms, but nodded. Bunta looked to the gathered faces.
Surely, the warrior should be welcome to take his rest, and we should thank him for what he has done.
In what was, for him, a show of great respect, Bunta clasped his hands and nodded to Jackson.
But I think it best for all if you go upon your way. The plains are no place for outsiders. It would indeed be a disturbance to the tribe, Jackson Vidalt.
Who are you?
Jack asked.
I am Bunta, son of the elder. Bunta gestured to Yucatan in deference.
Oh.
Huh. And that was all Jackson said. Chaki rubbed the bridge of her nose and sighed. She would have to handle this.
Jack has many strengths.
Chaki began. She stepped forward, into the small circle holding the other four. She took in the gazes of the gathered people.
But words are, admittedly, not amongst them.
He has no need of them. He speaks in actions.
Your compliments are as backhanded as ever, said Bunta.
I am not impressed.
Then be impressed by this,
Chaki said. Jack found himself in similar circumstances as us. He was a slave who ended up penned amongst the Radics, sold off, as food.
Naked, with naught but his bare hands, he broke loose and fought his way out. Just short of the entrance to the cavern, he found us locked in cages. He could have run the Radic were right behind him. But he stayed to free us, sacrificing an easy escape to break open our prison. But even then, Shaka's ankle was gravely wounded, and she could not run. We could all hear the Radic closing in, and I thought we were sure to be caught.
Chaki stared at Bunta.
Do you know what he did then, Bunta?
Jack remained behind.
He stayed and fought them so that we had a chance to get away. When we left him in the cave, alone, I thought it would be the last time I saw him. It was not. He killed the Radic that dared approach him and made such a display of his foe that the others fled in terror. Such is his might as a warrior.
But that is not all he did, she said. If that was all he did, then perhaps he would be worthy of a painting and our friendship. But his deeds did not stop there. Shaka's ankle turned out to be infected. She healed my wounds, but did not heal her own, for she judged herself a lost cause. I was distraught, for I knew I did not have the strength to cure her so soon after our enslavement.
But Jack had found an essence crystal in the aftermath of his battle. He freely gave this great power to me so that I could save Shaka's life. In saving her life, he saved the soul of our band.
Chaki jabbed her finger in Bunta's face.
Jackson Vidalt has 10 times the honor and spirit of any man I have ever met. If he is not one of the people under the mountain, then none of us are.
She nodded to herself and folded her arms, pleased with the reactions on the faces around them. Bunta looked taken aback. Yucatan reappraised Jackson with a critical eye. When she saw Jack again staring at his feet, she had to hold in another sigh. But he caught her eye a moment. He made his smile. She felt her heart flutter, and she was grinning back. She was sure she looked foolish, but she didn't care, and then she saw Bunta's face. He had not missed their exchange. She sensed trouble there. Despite her rather public rejection of his advances, he had not given up on her affections, insisting that he would ask her hand once again after he had displayed his honor to her at the Mountain Meets games. Shaka made her own firm nod.
Well said, Chalky. It is true that I owe Jackson Vidal twice all my remaining years, and as you all owe me for protection of your spirits, so then you owe him. We might settle this debt not by casting him as an outsider, but by welcoming him into our midst. Think of the bison!
She gestured past the teepees, out to the prairie. In the great herds, at rare times, the white bison can appear. It is known well that this color marks the animal as sacred. It is prime amongst its brothers, a sign of forgiveness between us and the lives we must take to feed ourselves, a reminder that even in hunting there is a sacred pact. Jackson Vidal is like the white bison. Shaka rubbed her chin, considering something for a moment. She looked to Yucatan. Is it not so, honored elder? Yucatan hesitated. The mood of the crowd was with Jackson, but that would force him to go against his son's opinions in public. Everyone knew that he was preening Bunta for intertribal politics. Weakening his son's position in the tribe by discounting his thoughts was something to be avoided, but Chalky could see the change on his face. He'd been backed into a corner. He nodded.
It is so, Shaka. Then tonight, Shaka said, let us celebrate. The spirits are high with this small triumph. We shall keep a feast, but only lightly, to preserve our stores for the meat, but let there be drums and dancing. Afterward, elder, we shall meet with Jackson Vidal in my teepee, and conduct the rite to bring him under the mountain. Then let it be so.
Yucatan glanced about. Spread word to your duties. Let us prepare a feast. There was a cry of excitement. The children scurried through the crowd. The women moved off in droves to seek the creek. Water would be needed to slake the thirst of so many, as well as prepare plentiful amounts of soup. The men went for the storage tents to retrieve dried meat and vegetables, as well as the wasna. Shaka always wanted plenty of wasna at the ceremonies. Chalky looked for Jack, but he was being jumped on by Pala, and it seemed Landry was speaking to him, as well. He was rubbing the back of his neck again. He seemed to have a few habits like that. Bunta approached her before she could close the distance.
Chalky, he said.
His hand intruded upon her shoulder.
My heart sings to see you again.
Truly. Chalky casually stepped out from his attempt at an embrace and kept her response neutral.
It is good to be back amongst the tribe.
Bunta looked over his back at Jack, then back at her.
Were you just exaggerating out of stubbornness, or did you mean what you said?
I did not say enough. She said.
It is a story worthy of its own war shirt. An outsider will have a hard time finding one of those, don't you imagine?
You're right.
Perhaps I will sew him one.
Bunta's lips thinned.
I noticed that you have a different way of addressing him. His name is Jackson Vidal, is it not? You called him Jack. His people shorten names, as a sign of familiarity.
Chalky said. Perhaps it was petty of her to enjoy this moment, but she was certainly amused with Bunta's expression.
Shaka calls him Jackson, at times. He allowed me to call him only Jack.
Bunta's frown deepened.
Chalky, it is, good, that you have a strong relationship with him. If you trust him, well, I will respect your judgment. But it is too much, too soon. We do not know who he is.
Chalky thought to snap that he hardly respected her judgment when it came to his proposal, but she remembered Shaka's words and sat on her pride. She decided to act like Jackson, and gave him only a vague shrug.
He is a good man. Of this I am certain. Someone of whom my father would approve.
The implication was clear. Bunta stared at her.
Do you mean to say that, Dash? Bunta!
Pala rushed up to him.
Bunta, come meet Jackson proper. You'll make the bravest two warriors on the plains.
Bunta glanced plaintively at Chalky. Chalky just smiled.
I'm sure you're right, Pala. Go on, then.
Bunta was pulled toward Shaka, Landry, and Jack. Shaki watched for a moment. The conversation was stiffer than overcooked jerky. She slipped past them and into the teepee. The warmth of the teepee's fire rolled over her. The summer day was warm, but the constant wind still numbed the skin. It was nice to be out of the elements. She quickly ruffled through their possessions until she found something better than leaves. Unfortunately, her best dress had been stripped from her during her time as a slave. She was lucky to have not lost more, but it still stung. Hide was always at a premium. The embellishment, though, of feathers and beads and bone, that took place over years. She remembered working on her dress while she was seated around the fire with the older women. When her father died, she poured herself into sewing to distract herself. It was in those moments that she learned how to stop being a girl and become a woman of the tribe. She lifted her old dress from their clothing pile near the back of the teepee. It would be small on her, and short, but it was still better than leaves. She stripped the broad greenery away and pulled the dress on. She smoothed back her hair. Her father's wealth was left behind in their horses. They owned 6 horses, only one less than Yucatan himself. Perhaps she would cajole her mother to trade one for a good stock of hides, from which she could work a new dress. That would provide material for her to sew something for Jack, too. And they could stretch the trade, include more foodstuffs, herbs and vegetables for their soups. They hadn't had much variety of late, she sighed. Only just home, and thinking about the household already. She should leave it to her mother and focus on her training with Shaka. A dress could wait. But she did want to work on a shirt for Jack. The hollow bones at the tent flap clacked together. Chalky looked over her shoulder.
Yes?
Bunta pressed through the flap without answering. Chalky huffed and folded her arms. and if I was undressed, Bunta? Then I would have begged for forgiveness.
My apologies, Chalky. I wanted to speak to you. I had thought our conversation finished. I thought it barely started.
You thought wrong.
What is it that you want? Is that all you have to say to me?
Bunta circled the fire and planted himself in front of her. Chalky did not move and did not look away from his stare.
I thought you were dead, Chalky. I wept where the others could not see. I cried your name into the night.
Would the sun have died, I would have welcomed it.
Melodramatics do not suit you, Bunta, and they do not appeal to me. I saw you looking at the outsider.
And what of it? Does the mighty Bunta now decree that I am not allowed to look at people?
You know what I mean.
What you mean, she said,
is that you want my eyes upon you, and not other men. I thought I had made myself clear, Bunta.
Chalky, I love you, Bunta said.
Your visage makes me ache to hold you.
He raised his hands, as if to follow through with his comment. Chalky titled her head.
Do not.
He forced his hands to drop.
I care not for your lust. As Shaka has told me many times, youth fades. Would you love me if I was an old, wrinkled woman? What I feel is not lust, Bunta said.
My heart pines for you. When you were gone, I cannot live without you.
Bunta, she said more gently.
My answer was no. It remains as such. I cannot accept your affections. They fell silent. The remnants of the fire crackled in the center of the teepee. The hide walls fluttered about as a wind passed them by. The smoke swirled in the air.
Why? My reasons are my own. I cannot be satisfied with that, Bunta said.
You shoved me away without a reason before.
Tell me why. What have I done to earn this enmity from you?
It isn't enmity. Bunta ignored her, continuing to rant.
Do you think I am not man enough that I would not give you strong children? Have I somehow soiled my honor or dirted yours?
Bunta, I cannot. He grabbed her shoulders and squeezed hard.
Too hard. If Mother Earth should die and the sun kill us all in its grief, woman, I must hear this.
It is not what you have done, Chalky said.
She put her hands on his chest and pushed him back.
It is what you have not done.
Bunta let himself be shoved away. He blinked lost.
What?
When the men go to hunt, Chalky said. Who lingers in the camp most often?
Bunta.
Bunta does, because he thinks himself too grand to hunt, for he is the son of the elder. When our enemy, the Iron Men, threaten our lands, who argues that we should do nothing? Who feels that we should give way like rotten wood?
Bunta.
When the hard decisions must be made, and the warriors gather to speak, who waits for his father's word before chiming in?
Bunta.
He opened his mouth to speak, but Chalky cut him off.
Yes, I hear plenty of what happens in those meetings, given to me through the wives of other warriors.
And what do they say?
They say that Bunta is too sheltered under the big tree of Yucatan, and that while his back is strong, his spirit is weak.
And most of all, you petulant child, when I was a slave, when I was stripped bare and my back laid open with whips, where was Bunta?
Ah, yes. Now I recall. Crying over his losses at the edge of the creek.
Bunta's mouth opened and closed.
His throat worked.
Hi, Chalky, it isn't like that.
It is, Chalky said.
And that is why I rejected you. I wanted to spare your feelings, but you insisted on knowing. I will hope the truth of the matter does you some good.
You have me wrong, he said.
I will show you.
Just you wait.
I will show you honor that is 100 times what that man possesses. You will see that I would be worthy in your father's eyes.
I don't feel much patience at the moment, she said.
Now get out of my teepee. And if you touch me again without my permission, I will break your fingers.
Bunta stared at her for a long moment, then turned on the spot and stormed out of the tent. His passing ripped the calfhide flap from the front.
Chalky felt her teeth grind in the back of her mouth.
Now she would have to sew it back together. He had to get in one last spiteful action, didn't he?
She could already hear his future whining apology if she bothered confronting him about it.
The bones of the teepee's entrance jangled once more.
Landry peered inside.
Chalky, might I sit with you?
It is your teepee, mother.
Yes, it is.
She gestured at the smoke still swirling from Bunta's departure.
But are these my passions?
Chalky folded her legs underneath her and sat.
No.
But you might sit with me anyway.
Ah, Chalky.
Landry kneeled behind her and wrapped her up in her arms.
Chalky leaned back into her.
I am sorry you had to do that.
Did you hear?
We got the larger points, yes.
Just myself and Shaka.
I made up an excuse for Pala to take Jackson elsewhere.
Thank you for that.
I am your mother.
Thanks are not needed.
Landry slipped to Chalky's side and sat next to her.
Chalky leaned her head on her mother's shoulder.
They sat like that for a time.
I miss father.
As do I.
Landry stroked her daughter's hair.
I wonder. Do you like the outsider, Jackson Vidalt?
What makes you say that?
It was odd watching you too.
Landry said.
I was reminded of myself, and your father. He was no good with words. I often spoke on his behalf.
Really?
I never thought so. He was always so eloquent with his stories.
Ah.
He was.
But that was with you, and Pala.
That was different.
In front of people, well.
I will say that he let his actions speak for him, but I helped communicate the finer details, on occasion.
As you did for Jackson.
Did I ever tell you that he almost became elder?
Chalky shifted and looked back up.
I don't think so.
Landry nodded.
Yes, it was just after Pala was born,
and he was looking to shift away from joining the war parties to only hunting. He was renowned in the tribe for his skill, as you know. He was very popular, because he never boasted, and shared his wealth freely. He gave much to Shaka, you know she and I had been friends since even before I married him, so he had the approval of the spirit guide as well. As a group, he was poor with people, but individually, he had a great kindness, a way of tending to each person that made him very popular. What happened that made him change his mind? He had no interest in politics. She said. When he was younger, he counted Ku with the best of any tribe, but after he married me, he had always told me that he only lived for one thing, to hunt, and provide for me, and you, and Pala, and to love us with all his heart. He said that winning my love was his greatest coup, and that his children were more important than a headdress. She shrugged. Yucatan was good with words, and a friend of your father. He came out in support of our current elder, and the rest quickly followed. He was a great man. Chaki whispered. He was truly a man under the mountain. Landry agreed. Bunta wouldn't be the same. Chaki said. His headdress would be his great love, not me. Jackson might make such a one, don't you think? Chaki chuckled. I believe that Jack would regard the feathers with little more interest than the dirt under his feet. He does not care for superficial things. That's good. Landry said. But he would make a good husband too, hm? You're teasing me. You can't fool your mother. I saw the way you looked at him. Is it his eyes, or the odd color of his skin? Mother. Landry chuckled. Ah, yes. It must be his brave deeds. It's not like that. Really. Perhaps. Landry said. I will scrounge up some hide for you. You'll need a new dress. Chaki sighed, grateful for the change of subject. I had thought to mention it, though, if any of it mysteriously transforms itself into a shirt that hangs from Jackson's back, you will have to eat your words. Chaki felt her blush rise again. Damn the dead son. He was very brave, in rescuing us. All right? That was all. I'm sure. Landry brushed Chalky's hair aside, kissed her forehead, then stood. I will have to do my part with the soups. Come join us when you have finished recovering. But take your time. No one will blame you for an absence, so soon after this sort of journey. Does Jackson have shelter? Landry's smirk could have split the sky. Oh, concerned, are we? We owe him a debt. Shaka has taken him in for now. Landry said. I will bring you water. Take some rest. Chalky felt the dim throb of a headache coming on. She yawned. Too much activity, too little sleep. Healing runes or not, nothing could replace good, solid rest. I think that is a good idea. Indeed. You'll want to be in top form for tonight, so you can impress Jackson with your dancing. Mother. Landry retreated from the teepee, laughing on her way out the door. Chaki huffed and puffed for a bit, working out her annoyance, then lay flat and wrapped herself in plenty of their blankets. Sleep took her quickly. Jackson still didn't understand how Pala had energy. The damn kid had just walked 10 miles with the rest of them, and he was bouncing around, pointing out objects ranging from cooking stones to dried bison turds. Apparently the dung was their main fuel source for fires. Jackson dragged himself behind, trying to absorb information, but knowing that a lot of it was leaking right out the other ear. The horses were amazing, though. A great herd of them was kept outside the main body of the teepees. Several of the men patrolled the great herd, pushing them around over the course of several days of encampment, so they could graze a wider area. They also acted as shepherds of a sort, keeping the horses from straying too far. Apparently they all knew their horses on sight, which was amazing to Jackson, because with his inexperience, it looked like a herd of clones. Still, the families marked their own horses with beads or feathers, or some other decoration, as a means of quick identification, and to avoid any confusion. Jackson stood at the edge of the teepees, watching the herd graze. Pala was in the thick of it, wandering around. Soon enough, he suddenly jumped on top of a horse and rode it bareback toward Jackson. A green-red-green string of beads was knitted into its mane. Pala pulled up short near Jackson, who took a few steps back. He didn't have reins or saddle. The control was all through his legs. Jackson wasn't sure if he trusted that. Careful. Don't worry. His tail can't even sweat flies properly. Pala leaned low and rubbed the horse's neck. Isn't that right? Jackson approached warily. He'd never seen a horse, let alone get close to one. He could see powerful muscles flex and shift as it moved its legs. He had no doubt that a kick from those hooves would cave in his skull. Heh? He didn't have to worry about that anymore. Not with a health bar. He walked forward and gently placed a hand on the horse's neck. It craned its head at him, watching him with fat black eyes. Jackson started rubbing the skin, feeling the mane. The horse snorted in approval. He found himself smiling. She likes you, Pala said. She? I didn't know. Yep. She's named Small Grass. And a zero on creativity from the Chinese judge. Huh? Jackson shook his head. Don't worry about it. Just a reference to something back in my world. Are we still keeping that a secret? Pala asked. Jackson nodded. I don't mind, but Shaka thinks it best not to worry people about it. I agree. So, until she says otherwise, let's go with Chalky's explanation that I was a slave, too. Technically, I was. Pala nodded. Suddenly, he looked past Jackson's shoulder. Hi, Bunta. I was just introducing Jackson to Small Grass. Jackson turned. Marching toward him was none other than the stocky Bunta. He did not look happy. Jackson Vidalt. We need to talk.
This story is continued in the next part. This podcast is part of the Erotica Podcast Network. We offer a free Erotica podcast and a premium patron taboo podcast which contains more intense sexual themes. You can subscribe to the premium podcast for $2 per month or support the Erotica podcast on Patreon to support us and allow members to request future stories and themes. Links are in the description. Thank you for listening.